Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 29th, 2020, and welcome to episode 227 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and data transmission, I guess. So I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts today. The first is Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. How are you?
Hello. I'm happy to be a corner of the retro computing round square
That's
table.
Right. Retro space computing space round table. Then also joining us is Carrington Vanston from Toronto. How are you?
I'm excellent. Just look at me.
Yes.
agree to disagree.
I'm doing swell. I put up Christmas lights today, so I'm also very scratched up. The trees and I had a disagreement, and the trees won.
And also joining us today is Blake Patterson from Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm well. Thanksgiving leftovers overload, but otherwise doing pretty good. Yep. Glad to be here.
Excellent. All right. So we are what now on the third episode that we've recorded after the point at which the podcast turned 10 years old. And we still have hosts trickling in that have not been here yet. So perhaps we can turn to Quinn to talk a little bit about the, you know, the sort of the meaning of the decade.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny because I just listened to the second episode where people talked about the 10th anniversary because, of course, there's a delay there somewhat in production. So for me, it's still a fresh topic. Well, first of all, the most important news here is that I've started a new podcast. It's called the Retro Computing Roundtable Roundtable, where I talk about 10-year-old episodes of this show. since the 10-year rule did come up in the last episode that I listened to, I thought it was pretty funny. It's, you know, I'm of two minds on that rule. I think, Carrington, you touched on this a little bit, but, you know, the 10-year rule, I think, maybe made sense in 2005 or so when someone thought of it. And maybe it will still make sense to future kids. But I do think that there is something materially different about, you know, the computers of the pre, say, 1995 era. Like, I really struggle to imagine anyone getting, you know, waxing nostalgic about beige commodity PCs. And yet, that's also probably my bias, my snobbery, because I will not at all be surprised when my 10-year-old nephew is someday nostalgic for the iPhone 3G or whatever. So, you know, the stuff that we're nostalgic about, I'm sure, seems silly to our parents and grandparents. So I hate to, you know, put a stake in the ground on that one, but there is, I feel like, at least something different about that era of computing when nothing was compatible and there were 15 viable platforms, and there was something, it was sort of a golden age of, I don't know, the early technology in a way, because we were at this point where the basics of what we were doing were so difficult that it was kind of like the explosion of patents in the early days of steam engines, for lack of a less tortured metaphor. You know, just generating video was so hard that there were 10 different ways to do it. And those 10 different ways gave all of the different computers such personality, and 10 different ways to store data on a floppy disk, and nobody could figure out the best way to do it. And so I think, you know, I think that just gave that era kind of a tapestry that has been lost once computing became, once we kind of figured out, okay, this is the best way to do everything. This is the best architecture, and this is the best, you know, video format, and this is the best storage and whatever. Then everything just became bland, and now it's just about software. So, you know, I can see people today being nostalgic for old games. I think that will always be the case. But I really do struggle to, you know, imagine someone being nostalgic about a PC from 2010, which would be technically retro by our 10-year rule. So, yeah, I wouldn't want to necessarily claim a snobby rule like only pre-1995 is officially retro or whatever. But I also wonder about that 10-year rule a little bit. But anyway, so that's my speech on that. As far as, you know, what 10 years of RCR has meant, I think someone else mentioned that Earl's podcast Retrobits was kind of their entree into the rebirth or modern retro computing scene. And that was mine as well. You know, I don't know if anyone here is also a Lego fan, but adult fans of Lego have this thing they call the dark years that everyone goes through, where there's some period of your life where you stop playing with Lego and then you become an adult fan of Lego once again. And Blake is showing his awesome Lego Apple IIc on the screen there. So, yeah, they refer to that as your dark years. And I think a lot of retro people have the same thing where, you know, there are some of us who've been continuous users of this hardware, but most of us, I think, stop using this stuff for 10 years or something and 15 years and then come back to it. And so I was starting to come out of that dark years in my mind. I was thinking a lot about the Apple IIgs. It was the machine that had the most emotional impact on me, I think. And it just pushed all my buttons, and it was such an underdog machine. And I started to wonder if anyone ever remembered that thing. And, you know, I think because we were so unconnected back then, especially in Canada, where there weren't that many BBSs and there was, you know, a lot lower population, so there wasn't as much community around the machines. So whatever machine you were a fan of, I feel like you were very much on an island. So, you know, I had my Apple IIgs, I had one Commodore friend, I had one Amiga friend, and I had one friend who had a PC XT, and we were all in our own worlds. And we didn't really have contact with larger communities. You know, there was a couple of BBSs, but there wasn't that. So there was very much that sense that you were on your own and you didn't really have anyone to share a lot of these experiences with. So that got me thinking, well, is there now a way to go back on the internet and find those people? Because, of course, the internet is nothing if not great at connecting weird niche hobbies with each other. So, yeah, I started Googling and I found Earl's podcast, and that's what got me started on this road. So, and then, yeah, once you start writing enough angry emails to the RCR, they start asking you to just show up and talk instead of writing angry emails. So here we are.
It was all about the you know, electrical capacity of lemons, I think.
Yeah, that's maybe what started it. Yeah, I had thoughts on that, that's for sure.
Yeah, Andy in the chat says, I really think that people will be nostalgic for current machines. Their generation will still have fondness for their past. It doesn't matter that they weren't the first. But yeah, and I think that's true. I wonder though, yeah, so I wonder if it's really about the past and it's just that computers figured heavily in our past, and so that's the thing that we're nostalgic for.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I actually read an article a while back about nostalgia. People are trying to figure out actively right now, is it a new thing or has it like always been a human thing? Like, is it is it an emergent property of how fast the world changes now? Or was it the case that Victorians were nostalgic for Edwardian houses or whatever? And the answer seems to be probably yes. The nostalgia cycle seems to be getting shorter, but it has probably already existed, I think, is the current consensus on it. But yeah, it's an interesting question, I think.
So probably a lot of it has to do with like how you spent your childhood. One wonders if those gray PC boxes really occupied the same sort of proportion of people's lives. You know, like it may well be the online part and not the actual machine that you use to get online.
Yeah, I can see that.
Mattered.
Yeah, I mean, I have, so at work, I'm the oldest person on our team by quite a bit. And, you know, my coworkers are all mostly 20 somethings and they are actively nostalgic about the early days of the internet. So, you know, they will go on about GeoCities pages and animated GIFs from 2004, you know, and things like that. So I see that already starting with them. And again, yeah, it's about that stuff instead of the hardware. The hardware is just the background of whatever the internet is on.
Doesn't matter what you watch Hamster Dance on.
Exactly. Or Chocolate Rain or what have you.
Yeah, actually, this maybe is a reasonable place for me to drop in a listener feedback. Chris wrote over email, said, I had taken an extended break from all things retro computing until this evening. Among other notable events was the purchasing of our first home. Anyway, listening to the show and one of the hosts mentioned a TCI. I suddenly remembered the TCI I had purchased back in 2015 on eBay, recapped by Matt Capps, great guy, semi-local. I'm sure you've heard of him. I think we have, in fact, mentioned Matt Capps as a place that will service your leaking capacitors on your old Mac motherboards. But anyway, the email continues. So I had to pull that out of the box in the garage and place it inside where it's warm, dry, and could be admired. This was my first machine I used as a kid way back in 1989, and so it holds a special place in retro computing history for me. And actually, I failed to copy that down, but Chris also had included a link to, I think it's sort of like a web page that has a lot of Quake stuff on it and things like that. But it's clear that Chris's childhood is a slightly different later era from mine, and but I can sort of see, I could see the 2CI having that place, the place of the computer you played with as a marveling child.
And it was a great computer. 2CI is one of the great ones. There's a song by the Lucksmiths, which are a great Australian band and have very witty lyrics, and they wrote a song about the single revival. So you can be nostalgic for anything. And there's lyrics in that that say, remember when I said you were too young to start a story with remember when? Well, that was then, and this is appalling. They're just like the funniest band. You can be nostalgic for anything, I think.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because I've had that thought about my nephew, who's 10 years old, and he has started saying things like, oh, I remember way back when, or, back in the day, and he it's just because he hears adults saying stuff like that. But, the kids absorb it. But it's funny when he says it, because I keep thinking to myself, you have no basis to say that, to say things like that. He'll say things like, oh, this is my favorite chapstick or whatever. And I'm like, it's the only one you've ever tried. You're 10. you don't have any range of experience within which to form an opinion about these products. I just find that funny.
Yes. What a supportive family that child has.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we're terrible. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have therapists on retainer.
Yeah, I recall watching some different TV shows with my daughter, who's, a teenager now, but on different networks. And I hear her friends, talking about reminiscing about this network and how sad, remember when this was around, and I had no clue that it was gone. Funny that what her friends are nostalgic about.
Well, yeah, I have similar conversations with my coworkers who are nostalgic for their early internet, because, of course, they were all born after, it was commonly available. And so they don't understand a world that existed before it. And it's very difficult to explain what the analog world was, when it was telephones and cassette recorders and, nothing was connected to anything.
It used to be possible to be lost.
Yeah, right.
That was a thing you could do, be lost.
Yeah, paper maps, explain. It's very hard to explain that world to people. It really is. It's pretty interesting.
And one particular aspect that keeps coming up to me with my daughter is just the fact that everyone wasn't immediately aware of everything that happened in the world. Okay, this happened. Well, and they did this 2 days later. Did they not? Why would they have done that? And it's like, well, didn't know there was no internet.
A boat had to cross the ocean with the news.
The world was a much larger place.
And every once in a while we do get the sort of drop back into it if the power goes out or whatever, the frontier servers fail.
Mm-hmm. Or if you've exceeded your Comcast data cap limit, newly enforced.
I heard about that.
Yeah, don't get me started on that. That's not vintage. That's but it could make you feel a little vintage if you. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. I guess we could probably move on to the actual topic of the show, which we decided Yeah. So at the end of each show, we attempt to like make some sort of a plan for what we're going to do with the next one. A couple times ago, our plan was just the single word regret.
And who knows? Maybe it wasn't a topic. Maybe we just typed that.
Yeah. That's right.
Paul often types that at the end of the show.
It's just a thing we all say at the end.
Oh, scrawled regret. On the wall behind us.
Regret this whole thing.
So this time what we said, though, was software other than on cassettes and floppies. And this could, you know, encompass many things. So there are no rules, whatever it is, that's, except not cassettes or floppies. Actually, even 8-track cassettes might be okay. Anyway, we're just sort of talking, I guess, about like ways of communicating data that are sort of unusual. So who wants to start talking about that?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, actually, because I was just involved on a thread on Boing Boing about that. People were talking about, I guess, someone got a, it may have been brought up here as well, someone got a PC to boot DOS off of vinyl. Uh-huh. And it was kind of a cool project. And so that started a conversation thread about the different ways that, you know, people have seen software distributed back then. And because software distribution, speaking of pre-internet world, software distribution used to be really hard. Like there was just, it wasn't easy to just send software to someone because floppies were really expensive. And so, you know, we've talked recently about flexi disks, for example, other promotional forms. And one of the things that came up was, so things like the Kaozen soft strip reader or the QCAT, you know, those attempts to make some kind of barcode transmittable software that never quite went anywhere, but I always found to be an interesting idea.
Those are the sorts of things I started thinking of first, too, is software on vinyl. There's lots of cool examples of software shipped on records.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that came up in that Boing Boing thread was, you know, someone who was younger said, well, that's just like QR codes. And I thought that was an interesting point, because QR codes are more like pointers to things. Like they do store data themselves, but they're always just a URL. Whereas things like the SoftStrip were trying to be the entire data storage format because there was nothing to point to. There was no internet. So it was a much harder problem that they were trying to solve mm-hmm. with that same idea.
I'm now foreseeing that this is going to just go spider off in a bunch of like very random directions. But it occurs to me that Blake had this as his item of interest and news. So
yeah, I didn't realize that. Quinn, did you say you were involved in getting this in a discussion on Boing Boing? You weren't involved in this project,
right? No, just talking about it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't see. I was like, whoa, did Quinn put that together?
Yeah. No, just talking about
yeah,
it.
That was it seemed kind of fascinating. You know, booting a DOS PC up entirely from vinyl. And I remember, not quite since I'm talking, not yet my turn, but I remember there was some magazine, like computer magazines. I think it happened more in Europe. I heard people talking about the European home computing scene in the 80s, but you'd get those little
flexi disks.
Yeah, well, the flexible square records, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And is that what is there a term for it? Yeah.
Flexi disk, yeah.
It had, you know, they have a little program for the Spectrum or something like that. So they were very colorful, I remember. And that was a while ago. So.
Sure, I found one, the floppy ROM, May 1977 issue of Information Age. That was the earliest one I could find. It was 6 minutes of audio and it held a 4K basic program in the Kansas City standard format for any 68K microprocessor. Oh, no, sorry, 6800 microprocessor.
Oh, wow.
There were a few of those. I think it was something like 5 of the floppy ROMs that were published by Interface Age.
Oh, interesting. Cool.
So they have like a little word processor on one of them and an accounting program on another. So, and since this show is just completely, entirely out of all kind of order, here's my eBay pick.
Oh, Information Age.
This is
Interface Age.
This is, I think, a 1978. Yeah. All 12 issues. It's actually not very expensive. This is about now a 32. One thing that this does not actually say is whether these have the flexi disks in them. But you can kind of read, like, on one of them, it says floppy ROM number 3, the word processor. And there's another one here. It's like floppy ROM number 4 and number 5. And we'll see.
But you don't know if in this particular auction they actually still have the discs inside the magazine.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. I think probably anyone who notices that there's a disc in the magazine will charge more than $32 for 12 issues. So yeah,
probably
it might be worth the gamble.
It'd be the first thing you took out though too, with the time when you had the magazines, and they probably wouldn't survive or stay attached to them. I think there's something interesting to call out between the booting DOS from Vinyl Now and the flexi discs. I mean, the booting DOS from Vinyl Now is sort of a funny stunt, and it's cool that someone took all the trouble to do that. But the flexi discs, or that idea of storing software in vinyl back then, I think was actually a really clever idea, because it's like we said, a really hard problem to distribute software. And the, you know, standard method of using a floppy disk was very expensive, much too expensive to ship in a magazine. But, you know, the machines at the time all had cassette ports, and most people had record players. So it's a pretty low barrier to entry to just move an RCA cable from your, you know, cassette player over to your turntable. And so I think it's actually a very, very clever solution to a very hard problem at the time. Whereas today it's sort of a funny, pointless seeming stunt, but at the time it was not pointless at all.
I think maybe one of the things that's even, you know, funnier about doing it thus on a 5150 is just because that's a kind of an unusual way to get data into a 5150. Like, I mean, they do have cassette ports, but you know, who knew?
Yeah, most of the vinyl programs that I found, like programs on vinyl, are normally, if they weren't something like this, like a flexi disc thing in a magazine, it was normally like a hidden track or a hidden thing, mostly for the ZX Spectrum. Seemed to be a lot of people sneaking ZX Spectrum code into their record albums. Album X1 by Peter Shelley. So the guy from Buzzcocks had a song called ZX Spectrum Code. So unsurprisingly, guess what that was? The Thompson Twins in 1984, looks like they released something called the Thompson Twins Adventure Game on FlexiDisc, also for the Spectrum. It's all Spectrums. I'd never heard of that one before. Right, so
I've got to get that. I want to see that. I love the Thompson Twins.
And they did their whole own game. It looks like you're supposed to guide them through forests and stuff. I don't know. It's like, okay. There was that guy recently on Hackaday, I think last year, found a Commodore 64 game hidden in the like the runoff track on a B-side of some Christian rock album or something.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
Cool. But again, it's mostly that kind of thing. Like, it's just like hidden things, not really just like, hey, we're looking to distribute software. Except maybe the Thompson Quince. They're hoping for a second career, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and Desert Bus was originally a hidden track on something, right? Was it a Genesis game or something?
I think
but it was originally like hidden software.
So the best one I found of all of them, I mentioned a while ago that when I was ripping all my stuff from CD, there was one CD I didn't get rid of right away because on it, it was by Information Society, the big hit that they were. And it was a CD that said there was like a video on the CD. And so I just never watched it. I thought, okay, I should eventually put this disc in something. It was not worth the wait. So I did eventually watch. But I know them as a band that did that kind of thing. So that's how I know them. So it turns out the last song on side two of their album, Peace and Love Incorporated, contains a 3-minute long modem transmission. Because their kind of music, they probably just thought it was like, you know, electronic music, whatever. But the song's title is 300 BPS N81. And so it kind of tells you how to connect to this thing. But the weird thing is, if you connect this to something in like terminal mode or ASCII mode and just download the text, it gives you a story written by this band that begins. So we're supposed to play in Curitiba in 18 hours, but our bus is being held hostage by the local promoters. They form some unholy alliance with the Brazilian counterpart of ASCAP, the PRS. Apparently the PRS has the legal power to arrest people and they want a piece of the national tour promoters' money. The local security force, Gang Mexicana, has been bought out for 1,800 cruzados and a carton of Marlboros each. The only faction still operating in our defense is Big John, our security man, and he's hiding in his room because a local gang is out for his blood because of a 1982 knifing incident in which he was involved. Our 345-pound road manager, Rick, only had this to say: hey, you wanted the life of a rock star. Paul, Jim, and I realized that this was one situation we were going to have to get ourselves out of. And like, it's this long story about them sneaking their way out of Brazil that like just goes on and on, ending with every word of this story is true, which probably isn't, and how they lost all their equipment in Brazil, but it's the most crazy thing. So Information Society is a very strange band, apparently. So.
It's a good setup, though. Get lamp.
Right.
Examine room. Well, connecting my coworkers to weird formats again, one of the things that came up recently was someone brought up Laserdiscs, and I had one of my favorite factoids about them is that they're much more like records than they are CDs. And that's, again, one of those things that I think people from a pre-digital and pre-analog or pre-internet world just can't conceive of, that just because it's lasers doesn't mean it's digital. And I think a lot of people don't realize that Laserdiscs are an analog format and that, you know, yeah, it's measuring the distance between the pits. It's not a binary storage. And yes, and it's actually spiral tracked, which is why they were part of why they were terrible. If you ever tried to seek between tracks or between chapters. So yeah, I think that's another format that's much odder than people realize it is, because it just seems like, oh, it must be have been a precursor to DVDs or something. But no, it's much more of a dead end than that.
And making it even odder, I believe, I'm not sure if it was standard, but I recall reading, well, like when I first discovered this, like, you know, 10 years ago or something, that at least there was the option that the audio portion could be digital. I don't know if it by default was analog as well, but not the video, you know, just the possibly the audio, and that makes it even stranger to me.
First Laserdisc movie I ever saw was a showing by like a downtown club. This underground club had got a Laserdisc player, and it was so cool. They had an imported movie from Japan. We're all going to go see this underground film called Gunhead, which was amazing. And then halfway through this cyberpunk cool movie, it says, flip disc over. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. And that moment killed that whole format for me. I was like, first one I ever saw, I was like, I'm out. Yeah. I'm never gonna watch anything on this format.
I remember my parents made me go to a in the neighborhood was a handwriting tutor, because my handwriting was so horrible that made me go to this tutor. And the one Laserdisc movie I ever saw, they were like this futuristic couple. They had all these gadgets no one else had, and was Time Rider. Do you remember, anyone remember that movie, Time Rider?
Sure.
I think Christopher Lloyd was in it as a cowboy or something, but yeah, Time Rider. It also had a flip disc, as I recall.
Fred Ward movie. I like that movie, actually. But I like cheesy films from the era.
I got really excited by Laserdisc at one point in, I think, high school or somewhere in there. And so for my birthday party one year, we rented a Laserdisc player. And there was only one place that you could get them in the entire city at the time. And it was like, it was an anime shop, which I didn't even know what that was at the time, but it was an anime shop in a bad neighborhood. And I talked my parents into driving me over there to get this thing. And we rented Aliens and Free Jack. And Free Jack
was... Oh my God, I haven't seen Free Jack in forever.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Speaking of cyberpunk Laserdisc experiences. Yeah. But yeah, so Free Jack was, flip disc moment. And Aliens was on two discs. So we had to flip and change discs. And yeah, it was a very disruptive experience.
Free Jack probably should have only come on Laserdisc, actually. That's like a fitting format for that movie.
Yeah, I feel like that was pretty at home on that format.
My gosh. Oh, Mick Jagger.
There was video on vinyl briefly, right? I feel like that came up either on a recent RCR or somewhere else. There was a brief experimentation with a video on vinyl format. I think RCA, I want to say, came up with that one.
I think Techmoan did a look at that video channel. That guy's amazing. I think he took a look at least one of those formats.
Interesting.
And there was also, I had a CD, I want to say it was Rush, that had a video on it as one of the tracks. And so you would put it in your PC or your Mac, and it would show this one file as, you know, it had like a CD-ROM track on it. And it was like 160 by 120 postage stamp QuickTime video that was like 8 seconds long. But this was 1994 or something. And so that was just amazing. Like, this was the future, that there was this video
on there.
It's
good enough for Myst. It's good enough for anything.
Yeah. It was awful. I thought of it when you said that it was not worth the effort. And that's how I felt about that, because I got it before I had a machine that would play it. And so I waited like 3 years to see what this video was. And finally, I had a Mac, my 660 AV, first Mac with a CD-ROM, put that in there. And it was a teeny tiny little QuickTime video that was 5 seconds long, and it was such a letdown.
I'd like to pause to mention how amazing the 660 AV was, though.
Yes. Was oh my gosh.
Great.
Incredible machine.
Stunning computer. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got to mention, it's sort of in line with this, but since we're talking about videos and discs and however close that is into our core topic, the first compact disc player I ever got in 1985 had a video out port on the back. And I wasn't mm-hmm. a RCA, and I thought, well, that's weird. I wonder what it is. It looked kind of like a ADV port or something. What I later learned, that was the CD plus G standard, which, some CDs could show a very slowly updating static image. You know, I think they would hack the ability to do scrolling lyrics sometimes, but it was very low frame rate, very low resolution. And I apparently, if I had just ordered a cable from Pioneer, I could have, hooked it up. I've never actually seen it, and I've never had in operation in person, and I've never actually had player that supported it after I knew that it existed. Apparently, it was not, discs would do this sometimes. They didn't really broadcast it. It wasn't like, hey, there's a big bonus thing. It wasn't a banner on. It would sometimes happen. That would have been cool to see. And that's sort of an interesting way to, little hidden bonus.
Was that CD plus G, did you say?
Yeah, CD plus G, also known as CD dash G, CD plus graphics, and also known as TV dash graphics. It was heavily used. Apparently, karaoke machines used that format or in variations of that format to do some of their stuff. Okay. I'm just looking at an article. It looks like Philips and Sony came together to create it, and it falls under the Red Book standard. I was early on the bandwagon. I consider myself. This was like 84, 85, and it was there. 288 by 192 graphics, or 300 by 216, with different levels of color.
So I remember seeing that logo on things, but I never knew what it was. I had no idea that standard ever existed. Mm-hmm. It makes me think of the DVD standard. Like, it's gone now, but we used about 1% of what was in that. Like, if you look at the early promises of what DVD players were capable of and what people could have done, like they were basically fully interactive computers that would play games, and you could have branching menu systems and all kinds of graphics and stuff. Like, there was so much that the DVD standard could have done that DVD players just never implemented, because it turns out the only thing anyone cared about was watching movies. But you occasionally get a glimpse of it. You'll go to the DVD extras on a movie, and there will be like a little graphical menu, and you can tab around to different screens. And but that was that was the tip of the iceberg of what you could actually do with just about any standard DVD player if anyone had ever bothered to try it.
Yeah, presumably you could actually just play Dragon's Lair on a DVD.
Basically, yeah. I think, they took a lot of their early inspiration clearly from Laserdisc games, because they implemented a lot of the stuff that the Laserdisc arcade games were doing already.
Will in the chat says that Sega CD supports, I guess, the CD whatever G.
is that right?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm correctly reporting what is in our chat. I cannot say further if that is correct.
Well, also in the chat, first Lemon Herb 1, I think, and then Andy Collins were having a discussion about broadcast software, which we haven't touched on yet. But there were a couple of different standards for people to
broadcast.
There was the basic code and telesoftware or whatever. And I can never remember which is which, but I think telesoftware was the one like the BBC did, and basic code was the one like all through Europe, like the Dutch started with it or whatever and would broadcast it in Germany. But the idea was they would broadcast software, and so you could just get it over the air. So
there were cable ones as well. If I'm not mistaken, Atari had a 2600, like a dial-in gaming service for the 2600 that like nobody knows about or never went anywhere, but there was a special cartridge you could get that you plugged into your phone line and it would download 2600 games, which was just mind-bogglingly ahead of its time, like 20 years ahead of its time. I think nobody understood it, maybe.
It would have had to be pretty quick, because it basically would have to have been 4K or less. So no matter how slow that thing was, I'm sure got a game pretty fast.
Yeah, and I think the games were very small on it, like even by 2600 standards. Like, the games from that service were limited to something like 768 bytes or something. It had some crazy limitations on it, as I recall, which is maybe why it never went anywhere. I think they had a real bandwidth problem. But it blows my mind that it existed at all.
There was a 2600 cartridge type system that you played a cassette into as well. I mean, like, it's kind of a similar thing. I forget what it's called. Like, it has like supercharger, turbo expander, something like that.
Yeah, just about every game console has something like that in Japan. Like every Nintendo, every Sega, you know, they all had some sort of gray market. We think this is legal. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, kind of hard drive or CD burner or, you know, cartridge dumping thing that you could go into a store and buy, but was probably not legal. They're pretty loose with that stuff over there.
And I actually, as before we move totally away from it, I actually found a website called the CD Plus G Museum, which apparently it's got a listing of all of the, well, I don't know if it's all, but a great many bands that support it. And as you you can click through, it'll show you examples of...
there they are.
Yeah.
The Information Society.
Information Society.
Oh, jeez.
Screen for those that are watching the YouTube stream. Yes, they're lost in the forest, and hopefully they'll find their way out. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. It looks like there's a lot of classical music that had static images and rock paintings, that sort of thing. So anyway, we'll include the link, and you don't want to miss the CD Plus G Museum. So.
Well, since we're talking about hidden data, one of the very first gaming industry jobs that I had, I was working at the company that did a Nintendo 64 game called Tetrasphere. That was their product that they shipped just before I joined. So I didn't actually work on that game. But, you know, the Nintendo 64 was a very primitive platform. You had to write everything yourself, basically. You got a compiler, but you had to write your own linker and bootloader and everything. And so we had written our own linker, and one of the engineers was sort of a cranky sort of fellow. He's no longer with us, so I feel like I can talk about him. He was a charmer, but definitely had a cranky streak in him. And Nintendo were challenging to deal with. They were, of course, the sole publisher for the platform, and you had to deal with whatever they wanted. And so they had a lot of producers and businessy marketing types that were not very compatible with engineers, especially cranky ones. And so just before we shipped that game, he went in and modified the linker and put a very long anti-Nintendo screed into the ROM. And he listed a bunch of producers and middle managers at the company by name and expressed a lot of opinions about them. And Nintendo did not catch it until the cartridges were produced and shipped. And so to this day, you can go and download the ROM for Tetrasphere, and you will find this rant in there. And suffice to say, that was the last project the company did with Nintendo. I think the company avoided a lawsuit. I wasn't sufficiently in the know on some of that stuff. But yeah, as the rant has also been transcribed online, though I prefer we don't link to it. But you can find it if you look hard enough. So yeah, that sort of thing definitely happened. And I think nowadays companies are much tighter about that. I mean, I've since worked for companies that will scan the ROM for all text and so on. So you'd have to work a lot harder to hide that sort of thing. But in the loosey-goosey days of the Nintendo 64, they weren't too careful about it. And they just took the ROM file we gave them and sent it to the factory and produced a million cartridges from it.
Excellent. Yeah, so... okay, a couple things from the chat. So Arcadia Supercharger is the thing. It was later renamed to the StarPath Supercharger. That's the name that I knew. But that's the one where you can sort of like there's like an audio cassette interface for the 2600. That is, you could download a game into a thing you plugged in.
Yeah, that sounds right.
It had, gotcha. It had 8K of RAM.
Ah, that's more than I thought.
It's a lot.
So I came across this, and I think a number of people have come across this in the past. This must be an early example of this. This is a there's a television program in 1984 called Database. And in this particular episode of it, they were demonstrating how to send an email or something like that. But at the end, they, you know, over the end credits, they actually have – they play a little thing that is – you know, it's really basically just like a modem signal. It really, and you know, to me, it really sounds like an emergency broadcast system test, but you know, in the event of a real tornado or whatever. But But the, you know, so the idea was you would just, you know, set your tape recorder up and record this and play it into your Spectrum. And, you know, 5 or 6 tries later, it might actually load a little thing. So that was pretty cool. So there was that. They did that, and they actually, there was a, like a sister program, called For Computer Buffs. I think I don't quite understand it. This is all Tim's TV, but I think it actually was, like the summer edition of the computer of the, what did I call it? The computer program. But, For Computer Buffs program, they actually had this little thing where they would put this little dot in the corner of the screen. Like it's a black circle, and in that black circle there would be a little blinking square. And so what you do is you make a little receiver and you stick it to your TV. They did a little demonstration of like how you solder together this receiver, first of all. You know, so this is like an experiment. You were supposed to build a little thing. It's sort of like a light pen receiver thing that you stick onto a suction cup, and then you stick it to the TV in the spot where the dot appears, and then you record it, and you hope.
Wow, I love
you
this.
Hope.
That is amazing.
Yeah. Huh. So, yeah, that was. I think that is pretty neat. And it would be definitely interesting to like see what they actually said, but and it's really super intrusive. There's, you know, the guy's like just talking about this thing, and you know, there's this big black dot which blinks.
Well, and it has to be inside the safe zone, which in the early days of TV was very small area in the middle that you could guarantee was not behind the bezel on anyone's TV, and so it's quite far into the middle of the picture there.
I like how your choices either are to not use this thing, so you have a huge black circle and a flashing look at me white dot, or you have to stick something over your screen and wires hanging down. Like, those are the only two choices. I love it. I completely love it.
This is great. I've never heard of this.
No, yeah. I never heard of this either, and I love it.
There's an example of this in an interview that they did with Sir Clive Sinclair. Which actually the interview itself is also a little bit interesting because the interviewer is kind of pushing a little bit hard on the like defects and the reason for a relaunch and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But at any rate,
I wonder if they could pick where this circle was, if it was always there, or if like, depending on the person, you like stick it over someone's forehead or whatever. Don't listen to Sir Clive. Boom. Well, stick this touching up over his face.
And in fact, actually, in the lead up
there's
to,
one top left.
Yeah, it's in a different spot in the sort of lead up to the thing about how to.
Because
well,
this will
it.
Also probably lead to burn in if they left it in there all the time.
Yeah.
Although it being all black, maybe not.
Anyway. Maybe it slowly drifts across.
That would be extra irritating.
I love this.
Well, and you'd have to know ahead of time where it was going to be to put your suction cup in the right place, or else you'd miss the first bit, and then it's over. You've lost it.
It sits there, at least in that one example, it sat there for like a minute, 2 minutes or something like that before it said, hit the space bar now.
Have you seen family members try to hook up things like VCRs? 1, 2 minutes? No. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they also had to solder this thing together. So, I mean, it's possible that they'd already fallen by the wayside.
The Venn diagram of people who could ever get that to work is so tiny. I'm reminded of the roller coaster laser disc game thing that Kay Savitz showed at K-Fest that year, where the amount of different pieces that you needed to assemble to get this thing to succeed was so – the barrier to entry there was so high that surely almost nobody ever saw whatever the thing – the content actually was. I feel the same about this, like the – barrier to entry here is pretty massive.
One last thing I wanted to say about this, you know, the little dot for Computer Buffs thing is that I was searching around on the web for just stuff that related to it, and there's actually a post on airgunforum.co.uk from what's this guy's name, from Tin Can Tony, who actually wrote the decoding software like worked with TemsDB, I guess, wrote the decoding software for the BBC Micro. So that was kind of interesting, you know, someone who had an actual connection to this. It's surprising though how little is kind of out there. Like there's a couple of examples in the Thames TV YouTube channel of this, you know, but I'm not sure that there's a full record of all the things that they transmitted. You know, I think there's just a couple of examples.
So. Yeah, it makes you wonder if anyone's archived this. And it's also the sort of thing I wonder how well it survives, like YouTube, for example. Like if you have a VHS recording of this TV show and then you compress it into MP4 and put it on YouTube, are you now missing certain flashes of that dot and the data would be lost?
Oh.
You know?
Right.
Because it might, I don't know how sensitive it is, but it could be pretty easy to lose one of the dots to video compression or something. So I wonder, this might even be unarchivable.
Right. Yeah, I was looking at the dot on the video that was displayed. It it looked to me, to my eyes, that it was shockingly slow in its alternating the flickering mm-hmm. of the dot. But maybe it's extremely fast. I mean, maybe it's, you know, every frame, you know, 50 frames a second. Pal, right? If it's that, you know, frequent, then it seems like it would almost be impossible to preserve it digitally.
I think it would have to be slow, I guess, in order for it to be successfully, like, reliably readable by a device that you can build on your kitchen table. Like, I feel like it's going to have to be pretty lo-fi for that to have any chance of working. But yeah, that's pretty cool, though. It's kind of like a much worse implementation of the French, what was it called? The teletext or whatever. They had the Minitel. Because that was the same idea. They were piggybacking data on an existing broadcast signal, but, you know, doing it as data and not as an optical conversion, which is sort of a silly way to piggyback data. And you think about the bandwidth they're using for that black circle, you can put an awful lot of data in that much radio frequency spectrum. So it's a really terrible way to send data, but I love that they tried it.
I think Slayer said in the chat, Bunny Hero says he hopes one of the things they transmitted was be sure to drink your Ovaltine.
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent.
Keep calm and blink on.
Well, we've been talking a lot about hidden data, and I guess, you know, there's not as gee whizzy, but I guess, you know, data that's not, you know, not traditional magnetic media. I think we talked offline about cartridges, ROM, you know, ROM chips. You know, some of the laptops take ROM chips, you know, which is non-traditional. I think we all probably have had, even back in the actual proper time context, systems that had cartridges to load their data in.
Everyone prepare your bingo cards. The PX8 was mentioned by Earl in the Discord as having some pretty cool little chip carriers, you know. So it was kind of somewhere a mix between a cartridge and a ROM, you know, like it was a ROM but in a little carrier that made it easy to insert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, CC40 TICC40 has a little interesting cartridge. I feel like it also has a backdoor for upgrading its ROM. I might be mistaken, but PX8 and a number of different laptops, I think.
What is that called? The HHC, the Panasonic handheld computer system, had used a pretty similar system where it's basically like a chip, but in a little plastic carrier, so you don't have to align the pins.
And I guess another thing, now that I think about it, you got me thinking about my little HP 100LX, which I'm still toiling with getting a compact flash card that works with it. But it has it and some of the other handhelds that I've used and have also will, you know, take program loading through IR infrared. So kind of interesting. Yeah, it's you can. I think I don't remember if the Newton. If the Newton has IR or not?
It did. Yeah, it had IRDA on it. Yeah.
Okay, and I think most of the palm sized PCs like the, you know, Philips Nino, that kind of thing, and then the clamshell pocket PCs, you know, they all had IR. I've actually not that long ago used a USB IR transmitter to, you know, load programs onto some of the Windows CE based devices. Yeah. So.
Yeah, if you I feel like IRDA was sort of the Bluetooth of the 90s. Like, it was this beautiful dream that just never really went anywhere. Like, all these devices had it, but they never quite worked together. And yeah, I had a job where we had a printer that had IRDA on it, and I tried to print to it from my Newton, and it just didn't work, and nobody knew why, and there was just no way to make it work. And was it drivers? Was it, who knows? It just never worked, and it was too low power to be used as a universal remote for your TV, which seemed like the perfect application for such a thing, but it didn't actually work for that because it was too low power. And
we could go stand just by the TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like physically touch the television with the.
I refuse to use the buttons. I am going to use my phone.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a universal remote thing for the Newton that I installed. But you had to be with like a foot away from the TV or it didn't work. But it
just
was.
Press the TV buttons physically with the Newton. That works.
I remember there was I think it was Computers and Electronics magazine. I don't know why I remember what magazine it was, but they had there was a system, an office communication system that someone had built, and it was rather drastically poorly reviewed, and it consisted of little modules, and they had a little small stalk, and you would put it on top of your CRT, and the idea was line of sight networking in an office space. Of course, once somebody apparently it's checksum system for any misses in data was almost useless. People would walk through the beam, and that we would restart.
And suddenly they're like, I'm thinking of software.
Yeah, it's a very terrible idea. I mean, I guess if you were to put it, like near the ceiling or something, I guess if the pole were taller, I could see that working, never saw that take off.
It's funny that we're all talking about how like none of this worked in our Newtons ever, and the chat is just full of people saying, I had a Palm and it worked great. We beamed things back and forth all the time and it was awesome. And everybody with Palm was like, what are you talking about? This was amazing. So it may have been the problem that we were all Newton people.
Yeah, apparently there was a niche for IRDA that I never stumbled into. So
the whole chat just filled up with people saying, works fantastic. Beam stuff between friends. It's just like all, oh, okay. Whoops.
Yeah, I was going to say something sort of similar. I was a Palm person, and I successfully printed for my Palm, and it was magical. It's like, I walk into the room with a printer. It was a printer that was shared among the people in the building, and like I was used to using printing it from my computer, but I was in a hurry at one point, and I thought, well, this thing has an IR. I wonder if that'll work. And it did. It was amazing.
Wow. I'm surprised.
Yeah. Nothing says Newton like it worked on other things, but we made it better, but more complicated and didn't quite work. Yeah. Welcome to handwriting.
That was really the story of the Newton in a nutshell. Yeah. It was all of its ideas were 20 years too soon.
Yeah. I think the thinking another advantage, with IR, I mentioned I used to own a number of Windows CE devices. A friend of mine online collects them and got me into, collecting them, unfortunately, fairly recently. And all you needed, instead of everyone had a proprietary serial cable. So if you wanted you have a collection of Windows CE devices in various form factors, in order to actually get data on and off of them, you'd have to have like a cat of nine tails of serial cables. It was just the one single USB IRD receiver and broadcaster I was able to communicate with all of them. And I will say, I was a Newton guy too. Well, I've been, Windows CE, Newton, like Palm, but I don't think I ever once in this recent, effort of moving data onto these devices that I collected in the past few years, I had any kind of problem. Like, it just worked fine. It was solid as a rock. So maybe Newton was a little weak on the IR side.
That was a story of the 90s for sure. Those serial cables, every device. I had a drawer full of weird custom proprietary serial cables. Yeah. I don't even know what they were.
Terrible.
Yeah, I had a universal remote for my home theater that was programmed with a proprietary serial cable. And like everything else in the 90s also, the drivers for it weren't maintained. So it worked for like a year on a particular version of Windows, and then it stopped working. And then I could never again reprogram my remote because they didn't update the drivers.
I've got on the shelf two four-way serial switches with printed out labels saying like Magic Link, Newton, Philips Nino, each one. And the funny thing is some of those proprietary connectors, especially way back when, weren't that much smaller than a 9-pin serial port. So you could have just put a sub D on it. But yeah, that's terrible, finding those cables.
It's funny, people are talking about this, the handwriting recognition in the chat there. And I don't know, did anybody watch the Apple event recently about the newest iPads?
Yep.
It was literally someone took the design document for the Newton and handed it to the iPad team and said, do this. It's every single feature in it. The scribble to erase, the recognizing shapes, yep. the connecting lines, it's like the way it fills out forms. It's 100% the Newton UI. And
I had the exact same thought. I kept wondering, did they hand them the design document or say, hey, this matches also the patents we own. How convenient. Yeah. Do this.
Yeah, I wonder, already right? patented. Yeah. Yeah, the similarities are way too close to be an accident. Like,
especially when they did the scribble. I was like, okay. I feel like I'm watching something back in time.
Yeah, my head was exploding. I was like, you promised us this in 1994, and it was terrible.
But this time it'll work.
Interface aside, just a note for those that may not be aware listening, even with early Mac OS X, there's no interface element to it. It was just a little box, but they had a handwriting recognizer in early Mac OS X, which you could use, you know, if you had a touchpad or like a artist's touchpad, you could write in this box, and that was directly used the Newton's Rosetta handwriting recognition engine, which interestingly is another project name for their emulation layer on Mac OS. But yeah, that was literally taken from. But I guess only recently has the interface been brought over.
Mm-hmm. At one point, I got this quite a tangent. We've gotten pretty far away from our topic, in fact. But at one point, I got a Newton, you know, a Newton and a bunch of stuff that came with it. But one of the things that came with it was like some software, including Graffiti. So I had not been aware prior to actually having that in my hand that the company that made Graffiti made it for the Newton as well. Like, yeah. So that's the thing that Palm adopted, you know, so it didn't have to read your handwriting.
Yeah, I did actually install Graffiti on mine finally. I gave in, and I was thinking about this the other day, actually. You know how there's this thing where tech enthusiasts will convince themselves that something is good even when it isn't, and you will put up with a lot because you believe in the dream of the thing so much. That was me with the Newton. I was so determined to like that thing, and I tortured myself for a year using that. I took notes in university on it, and I put all my contacts in it. I put all my business stuff in it. Like, I was determined that thing didn't suck, and it just really sucked. But I did finally give in on the handwriting, and I installed Graffiti. And we were actually cautioned not to do that back in the day, because we were told you were going to wear out that one spot on the touchscreen. And so I was a little bit nervous doing it, but you know, I mean, I never owned it long enough for that to be a problem, but the Graffiti was, yeah, worlds better than the Newton official recognition for sure.
Yeah.
Actually, before we move on, it just occurred to me, we'd never mentioned, I guess the way I got software, if I got software myself that wasn't on disk or cassette or something, then it was probably that I just typed it in, like listings for magazines.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Big distribution thing, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to mention that too. And that actually got pretty sophisticated. I don't know if people remember Compute and Nibble.
They had those checksum things.
Yeah, they were doing binary listings, and they had their own tool. So you typed in the tool, and then you could use the tool to enter their hexadecimal listings with the checksum at the end. Like, that was all pretty sophisticated and actually worked really well. I typed in that Nibble racing game, the driving game. I typed that thing in using their tool, and it worked the first time because of the tool. And I think it took 2 days. Like, it was a huge program. I mean, it was like half of that magazine, as I recall. There's just page after page after page of hex. And the game wasn't very fun, but it did work.
It would work with all that typing, though.
Yeah, it was amazing that it worked. The tool was actually excellent.
As long as you could fly solo well enough to get that tool typed in without checksum.
Well, there was a smaller checksum tool.
It's like, yes.
Yeah, before they came up with that idea, like, I had tried to type in multiple things, and they never worked, like, at all. It was just, even the basic stuff, the meticulousness of proofreading required for them to actually work bug-free was just, it was impossible to make it work, I think.
Interesting. Curtis mentioned in the chat that Rainbow Magazine had a similar kind of like checksum program for the Coco called Rainbow Check that worked on basic programs, and it ran in the background. So I don't know. Yeah, like, I'm not sure exactly how that was implemented, but I mean, like, that seems like a pretty good idea. As you type it in, it shows you like what your checksum is so far or something.
Well, one of the problems with the magazine typing, you know, without the checksum, and plenty of listings didn't have checksums, was, you know, the magazine might actually get it wrong, you know, and they would then the next issue, they'd say, by the way, you know, you spent like 4 days doing this and then you've been banging your head against the table. It's not your fault. We forgot, you know, this. That was great. Good.
It says a lot, though, how desperate people were for software that they were willing to do that. Like, I was willing to do that. I was willing to spend hours and hours of time, you know, transcribing hexadecimal into my Apple II Plus because that's how badly I wanted to try this Nibble racing game.
Yep. Or to learn stuff. I would type it in because then I hoped I would understand it.
Yeah. That doesn't work as well with machine language entry, though. I mean, like, you have to be pretty sophisticated to be able to say, LDA. No,
it's more for the basic listing stuff.
Yeah.
I love the Beagle Brothers one-liners and two-liners for that reason, because A, you learn something cool, and B, the investment for the reward ratio was very good. Like, it took you 1 minute to type it in, and then something really crazy and wacky happened.
So. Yep.
Yeah, computer mood or whatever it was.
Yeah, exactly.
There's one thing that we didn't talk about that's right in this domain, and I had it ready to so I could screen share it. But is the cause, and this came up, but the evolution of this is the soft strip. Like something like the QR code that we were talking about before, the sort of like listed down pages. So they would actually just be like long strips that you would run through the reader.
I have to recommend the Antic Atari podcast here. They did an interview with the inventor of the Kaizen soft strip reader, and it was fascinating. Like, he talked all about, it's one of those things that it's a much, much harder problem than you think it is to make a barcode reader that will work on, you know, poorly printed mass market magazine paper. And he talked in great detail about the electronics challenges and the physics challenges of making that work reliably. It was really, really interesting. It's one of the earlier interviews they did, so you would have to dig way back in the archive to find it. But great listen.
Or you could just click the link in our show notes.
Oh, great. It's already there. Yeah. Yeah. Because he was the same guy that designed it for all the platforms. So it's good for not just weird Atari people.
Cool.
Yeah, and there actually was somebody even somewhat recently who did a thesis on reverse engineering it in a modern context, you know, so that you could, like, sort of going through and training a neural net, you know, or perceptron thing to like read these things and correct for the skew and all that stuff to try to, since it's actually a little bit hard to find these things now, you know, like the hardware to read these things. But it is actually kind of interesting. This is 2018, I think, that this thesis was written.
Yeah, University of Calgary. Go Dinos.
Oh. Is that for real?
That's where I went. It's just,
okay.
You're supposed to say that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess that was our sports ball team. I don't know.
Apparently sports thing. Of all the university I've gone to, the only one I know is Western. The first university I was at was the Mustangs. I have no idea. U of T, Sheffield, Queens. I don't even know what their sports teams were called. I finally stopped pretending to care. pretended for like 3 years. I'm like, let's face it. I'm not going. You don't expect me to go. Let's just move on.
All right. Are there other things that we should have mentioned in our long list of non-floppy, non-cassette?
We're like an hour and a half in. We've covered it. We got it.
Yeah.
People will write in.
Yeah. There's a surprising amount of them. I'm surprised.
It did actually last, this topic lasted longer than I was kind of thinking it was going to this morning when I was thinking, like, what? I can't think of anything.
One more.
Flexi discs.
Packet radio on CB.
Oh, yeah.
That's another weird one. Yeah, Pearl
would have talked about that.
Yeah, exactly. People do still play with that, but it's another interesting way to send data.
Yeah. Earl can talk about it next episode when he's on.
Yep.
That's right. Yeah.
And probably people will write in about the 50 things we forgot.
So. Oh, yes.
Okay. Let's see. So I guess maybe, should I talk about listener feedback? No, I won't. I'll save that for next time.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we can move straight into the items of interest and news. Blake has the first one about booting at 5150 from a vinyl record. It's possible that we don't need to do that. I don't know. Is there more you wanted to say about it?
I don't think so. I thought about interjecting. Yeah, basically, and Quinn probably knows more about this than I, having been involved in the discussion there on Boing Boing. But the IBM PC, if everything else fails, as it goes down the list of devices to try to access to boot, it goes to the cassette input, and it'll start reading. And the guy took FreeDOS, he shrunk down and modified the FreeDOS kernel, which is DOS-alike, and in order to fit within the memory constraints, patched some things together, and basically got it booting that way. So quite novel. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's interesting that I guess it stands to reason that given that IBM apparently would sell you a model of the PC without a disk drive and with a cassette port, that it would boot off of cassette, or otherwise that's a very expensive paperweight. But this was done in a modern context. So, and that's about all I have on that one.
I wonder if you could do it with like a wax cylinder. Like, how far back can you go?
Yeah, why not, right? I was going to say that you could do it with an iPod, the same way that the Apple game server works, where you can just literally play audio files off the internet directly into your Apple II and boot games that way, which is I love that, even now analog is still the easiest bridge, or analog audio is still the easiest bridge from one device to another. So spanning 40 years, you can just download games directly into your Apple II from the internet because of audio. I love that.
Because everything has a headphone jack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then Apple noticed that was the case. So yeah. We can fix that.
It was a good run on the audio jack.
Yeah, the game server was nifty. I used that on the 2E a number of times. It was quick and a nice way to go. Just plug it into that audio jack.
All right. I guess we can move on to the next thing. Carrington, you have that next thing.
I'm going to use buzzwords. SaaS, baby. Software as a service. It's the future. Everybody's investing in it. It's awesome. And the first one that's caught my eye that's actually cool is this thing called Restuff, because sometimes old things are not old enough for you. And by you, I mean me. So Stuff It was the standard for ages for shrinking down files on the Mac. It was like the old Mac's version of Zip. PCs had Zip, Mac all used Stuff It. But then Stuff It moved eventually to version 5, which for a number of different reasons ended up being kind of incompatible with using it for System 6. So if things like System 7 on the Mac are just too newfangled for you, like you think Multifinder is a fad, you are modal to the core, you want System 6, then all the Stuff It archives out on the internet can be a hassle, because they're often in Stuff It in a version like 7.5 that's just too old for you. So Restuff is simply an online site that will take your Stuff It 5 thing and turn it into a Stuff It 3.5 thing, so you use it on System 6. Super convenient, little monotask. Basically, it's a website, software as a service. You go there, choose a file, click a button, it says here. And how it does it is kind of neat. So you choose the archive, and then it launches a version of Bascos 2, a virtual machine, launches System 7.5, runs it, actually does this. It does it all. Then when it's done, it has the file you want, copies it back to you, deletes the disk image, deletes it all, and just there. It's like you got a buddy on the internet just willing to do this for you. And it's great. Like, how cool is this? What a neat thing. So it's Restuff. It's awesome. It's free. And it actually does something useful. So if you've been trying to run things on a really old version of the Mac, or maybe a really old version like on vMac or something like that, you're trying to run a System 6 thing in emulation, it can be a pain to download games and stuff that are in Stuff It format but just won't open for you. This will probably solve that problem. So
I do love that computing is so cheap now that it's worthwhile to run a VM and a foreign operating system just to convert a data format.
Totally. Yeah. It's awesome.
Much simpler than figuring out how to decode and re-encode it.
Exactly. This was probably quicker.
It almost certainly was quicker.
So. Yeah, just an automator script or something.
Yeah. I love it. So easy peasy. Anyway, it's cool.
And I don't know if you noticed like what site that was on.
JCS.org.
Yeah. And JCS.org is in fact the site of Joshua Stein, of our previous discussions of the Macintosh 512E and programming in whatever that is.
Well, cool. Yeah.
So, lots of cool stuff.
Very cool.
Stuffit is also a close cousin of Shrinkit, which was the standard on the 2GS. That was kind of its compression of choice. SHK.
Yeah. I have this feeling about Stuffit, which I think I probably share with most people who lived through the Mac era. Oh, I love Stuffit. It was so great. It did everything. I liked it a lot. And then it turned into this nasty, horrible thing that,
I remember that. There was a moment where it stopped being this, like, transparent tool that always did what you wanted and turned into this behemoth, like, something or other that was a pain in the butt. Yeah.
Right. And if I'm not mistaken, simultaneous to that, they brought it over to Windows and were trying to get people to convert, start using Stuffit on Windows, which,
They already had Zip that they weren't paying for. Why do they want to not pay for your software, too?
Yeah.
Right.
My thing is actually something that was sent over feedback. It is Spectron sent it over Twitter. It's about this game, Alchemstone. And I don't think we've talked about this before, although I think that this game might have shown up before. Do any of you know this game?
I do not.
Never heard of it.
Okay. It's a level 10 game. It is, it's an adventure game. It's pretty rare. But the thing that's sort of interesting about it, so the gimmick it had was essentially that it was an adventure game. It had a bunch of clues in it. And the clues were supposed to lead you to the location of an actual thing in the actual world that you could find and get a reward for. But it turns out that this company folded after like a year and, like nobody bought the game. As far as anyone knows, no one has actually like solved it. The person, I forget if this is actually where it is. Yeah. There's a lawyer and there's an author, and I think both have been contacted about it. But the lawyer is the one that was supposed to be sort of like doing the verification. And the lawyer just said, well, no, as far as he knows, there's no one has collected this. No one has gotten anywhere with this. He hadn't thought about it, in 39 years or whatever. So what this is a sort of like a, it's kind of going through just sort of what's in the adventure, just in case maybe, we could figure out what the answer is. So it seems like it is really basically just an exercise in tedium. So half of the map is shown on the screen here. It is a grid of like, it's just a grid of, squares with directions in them. It's kind of like a wizardry kind of maze. Every once in a while you wander around and it'll give you some clue. One of them says, my first is sixth. My second is content. My second is content, followed by the rest. Finally, a child could play. Nonsense. Who knows what any of this stuff means? Sometimes there's some little symbols. This person that kind of went through and took screenshots of like all the clues, and the clues are actually relatively well hidden. Here's one of the things looks like a little dot from the
TV program.
You're supposed
to put that thing over your screen.
Yeah, suction cup over that, and
it'll blink at you.
But apparently you walk through, and then sometimes after pausing a little bit, a clue will come up if you look in the right direction. Person has just gone through and like looked in every direction, waited a little bit, looked in every other direction, waited a little bit, got kind of
tired.
Seems
like something that should have been coded. Write software to go through this software.
But there's a few subsequent posts showing the full map and a few more like ideas about what this might be. I think it's been kind of, I think the current view is that it's kind of localized somewhere in DC. So Blake, maybe you can go find it.
Interesting. So it's an object that theoretically physically exists. It may still exist somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they,
or when the company went under, some employee went over and just took it.
Yeah. Did they buried something, or is that what that was supposed to be the idea?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that even that was even indicated.
I wonder if it was you just were supposed to write to the company with where you thought the thing was, and they would tell you if you were right, but there wasn't actually ever a thing.
Mm.
So in the, I was kind of side searching this as you were talking about it. It hasn't been solved, I guess. Okay. But clues have been brought out.
Yeah. Well, so this, I mean, I think this, the beginning of this blog post was the spring, I think. So this is a pretty recent attempt to try to go through and document all the clues and try to get some ideas about what this could be.
This is the sort of thing where I feel like Twitter could solve it in 8 minutes. Like, if it just went a little bit viral, it would be solved instantly.
Yeah. Like most augmented reality games or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But
that's interesting.
Because I'll see those. Those will pop up on the net and I'll go, oh, that'll be interesting. And it's done.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Exactly.
what? I missed it. I was reading it and I missed it.
And this was Apple II, right? Judging by the screenshots?
Yeah, it was.
Well, if people in the chat figure it out, I'll grab my video camera and get in the car, and we can okay. live stream the digging.
And the arrest and the lawyers.
Let's see. 1600 Pennsylvania. What? All right, let me try to climb that fence.
Well, and this was an idea that came up a lot, right? Like, people had this idea to create a mystery that had a real world element to it. I feel like they always went horribly, horribly badly. Like, someone got hurt, or the company got sued, or they didn't think anyone would solve it, so there was no thing, or they didn't have the prize money because they didn't think anyone would solve it, or just something goes wrong every time.
Kind of like geocaching, right? Sort of?
Yeah, yeah. Like a neat idea on paper. But
I've heard tales in some of the true crime podcasts I listen to of geocaching going sort of south.
Oh, goodness. I like geocaching.
Come deep into the woods at this certain spot, and oh, look, someone's here already.
Yeah, I feel like this came up actually on some earlier episode, but there was this book called Masquerade that was, in fact, sort of famous edition of this, or like a version of this idea, where there was like a golden rabbit that was hidden somewhere, and it really did, as I recall, it did kind of end not very well. I mean, like, there was a very elaborate set of puzzles that were supposed to, like, lead you to the rabbit, and the person who actually wound up finding it was just told by the author's girlfriend or something like that where it was.
Yeah. It's not even the idea predates computer software. Yeah. They were, I feel like they were like Victorian novels and stuff that did this as well. And yeah, it never succeeds as well as you imagine when you're writing such a book.
Right. Anyway. Okay. So, feel free to go read that blog post and solve that mystery. Okay. We can now move to the next one. I guess the next one, it is you, Blake.
Okay. So we've talked about the Total Replay. Am I right that we've talked about Total Replay?
Yes, and it's amazing. Yes.
Just a recap for people that may not be aware. Total Replay is a single 32 megabyte volume, a disk image of currently up to, I believe the current count is 333 of the most popular Apple II games in one place that boot into a nice system that shows previews of the games. It gives you several shots of each game, easy access to launch them. It has an attract mode. And some of the meat of what came together here is it's all taken from original discs and the protection was removed. There's no crack screens. It's very clean. You're not missing it. Sometimes music would be taken out of a game to make room for this or that. That's not the case. It's just as everything was. And in order to get all these on one large volume, it had to use a operating system, the later operating system for the Apple II called ProDOS, that supports large volumes and that sort of thing. Almost none of these games were written with that in mind, so I believe disk operation code actually had to be modified in order, in some cases, to work with this. So it's a Herculean task done by Apple II, A24AM, and Cucumba.
And they're both brilliant, and it's insane. Like, version 4, like, added 100 games and made it smaller.
Yeah.
How are you doing that?
Yeah, definitely over 100 games have been added to it since we've seen like three or four, two or three major updates, I think.
Well, and 4AM has been doing these incredibly elaborate transitions between the screens on Twitter, mm-hmm. which are amazing to watch. He's doing like pixel correct, like maple leaf shaped, you know, double high res transitions between the box art. Like it's crazy. Just madness. And it's like, yeah. Oh, and this was only 50 bytes. What?
And it's, he's been making it faster and faster, like yeah. cutting cycles out. It's, yeah. It's amazing.
Incredible, impressive, and also just a really fun way to play a bunch of games. Like
yeah.
everything about this is amazing.
Yeah. Of course, everyone has their favorites, but you pretty much are taken care of as far as Apple II gaming, the whole experience with this thing. And I run it on my CFFA 3000. It's a floppy hard drive emulator. It boots up just fine, and you can run it with different devices, or you can actually mount it as an actual disk volume. But what I did here, this is a blog post that I put together, and the purpose was I took a video of it running. I've my TUI is equipped with the other half of this situation, which is the VidHD device. And I know we've talked about this as well. The VidHD, just briefly, is a video card you put into the Apple II. It will output clean HDMI with different effects in place, scan lines or different types of it emulates the different sorts of NTSC artifacting, which is how the Apple II generates color. You can have different approaches to this, one that matches the way the 2GS does it. And it actually, what happens is it does this by monitoring the bus on the Apple II, and it recreates the Apple II video screen in its own hardware. It has an FPGA and some processing hardware. It supports all models of the Apple II, including the 2GS, which means it has the 2GS is 640 by 200, 4096 color palette modes. And on a non-2GS machine, a lower Apple, it can actually display 2GS mode graphics, even though your Apple II is not capable of that. And on Total Replay, one of the features is that in this attract mode, on your external display, I have two displays connected, but on the external display, it will show some of the games have scanned box art, and using 16 color, 4096 color palette, 320 by 200 graphics, it shows an actual high quality image of the box on, like I'm running on a 2E, so I'm seeing a 2GS quality representation of the box. And, my actual 2E monitor is blank because, it doesn't know how to display that, but the VidHD mm-hmm. is doing it. And I put together, I just wanted to, these two pieces of the software package and the hardware have been discussed in, greater length than I go into elsewhere, but I wanted to demonstrate, how it looks, with that happening on a non-GS. And so I have a video where I'm, kind of zoomed in and zoomed out during the attract mode, and it shows the 2E, displaying some of these images of box art that, frankly, most of us had never seen before.
Right.
What's a box? I'm sorry.
What? Yeah, it's strange. Like, it's interesting. Some of them I had, but, certainly I learned some things. And it's just it's kind of a really cool thing to see an Apple IIe, or it'll do it on an Apple II or a 2 Plus, able to generate these, higher quality images. And the video also just shows some of the nice, ways the attract mode is running. Hats off for how that's put together with Total Replay. And John Brooks has put the VidHD device together. It's his project. He was a well-known software developer. He created Raston, which is one of the better-loved Apple IIgs games back in the day. And he's been improving the device. I actually have I'm on the waiting list to get an actual device. I have a beta version. I was a tester for the device. So I don't have the last feature I'll mention of the VidHD, but it has, now it has some really massive text modes. It supports 40 by 24, 80 by 24, 80 by 45, 120 by 67, and 240 by 135. So you can actually, you can have software that taps into this specific mode on the VidHD and then, go crazy online with your BBS or something like that. And there's a fellow from our Slack group, Jay Kraft, has been playing with this, doing some impressive actual animated demos using that mode. I'm showing an image. It's a text mode version of picture of Woz, sort of ASCII art, that's using the 240 pixel wide text mode. He recently put together an animated demo that shows a spaceship, you know, a text spaceship flying through space with little closed Apple text symbols, you know, here and there on the screen. But it's the point of the thing was just so, you know, people could take a look at how this thing works and how these two things kind of come together in a nifty way, doing something today that, you know, you couldn't really do back, you know, way back when. And that's some of the nicest, you know, situations you can find and play around in for, you know, modern retro computing, in my opinion. So anyway, we'll put the link, and there's a YouTube video, and you know, I talked a little bit about this and that.
It's one of the coolest things about the VidHD for me is that, you know, it's one of those things where in hindsight, of course it does this, and it's obvious that it would be possible to do this, but I would not have thought of it. And I love that they went to the trouble to make sure that worked, which is to write to memory addresses that don't exist on the Apple II Plus. And it will still detect those because it's monitoring the bus. And so it will display those video memory addresses as if the machine did have them, and will display super high res graphics on an Apple II Plus, which I love that. I love that they made sure that worked.
Yeah, and the text mode, I mean, who knows how far this will get expanded. I mean, these text modes don't exist, you know, on any Apple II, but you can tap into them. You know, maybe higher palettes will come. I don't know. It's just interesting. What you can do with this is, if you think about it, is a lot more than, you know, it would appear on the surface. And it's just a really cool piece of hardware. And right now, like I said, you know, there is a bit of a wait. You know, I'm on the waiting list. I think I got on the list about a month ago, and more will certainly be made. It's just a matter of getting things out to people that are ahead. So, you know, again, this is one of those things where I sadly, I don't have the price on the top of my head for the VidHD, but it's not a lot. And
yeah, it's 130-ish or something. It's
very reasonable, yeah.
I'm sure it won't be made forever, you know, but like this is, even if, you know, for $130, you know, just go get one if you have a slotted Apple II and you use it with any frequency. It's pretty impressive. But
yeah, I bought one and I don't have a slotted Apple II currently, is because, again, like we always say on this show, mm-hmm. you got to buy this stuff when it's available because it won't be for long. And so I have one and it's sitting in my closet because someday I'm going to have an Apple II with slots in it again, and I'm going to want to be able to plug in my HDMI TV.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, and it takes it's upgradable. Like if you have a production board, the ROMs, you know, you can update the firmware. So it's, as you keep getting those evolutions, at least, you know, within reason. Who knows where it'll go? Maybe 3D graphics acceleration will be added later. Who knows? But
there is a lot of horsepower on that board, so it's totally reasonable that they could do, you know, emulated sprite hardware or, you know, any number of other cool things. Like, it's starting to become a graphics platform in its own right, you know, with the new text modes and the way that software is supporting it already. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, one day we'll be looking back nostalgic for the original VidHD, you know, back to old games, which, you know, weren't 3D and you didn't have to use a VR headset. You know, it was we remember the Sony, the PlayStation, and the Xbox. That was good old times. But VidHD has usurped all of these now, of course, 30 years in the future. I hope someone takes a look and enjoys the little demo of those two together.
Yeah, I definitely am thinking, you know, I've thought for a while that if the VidHD does get wide enough adoption, then you really could start targeting that.
For sure.
And I do kind of, another thing I wonder about, the answer is known, and it's just not by me, but is it possible to do different things on the different screens? Like, so can you sort of, at least in an underpowered Apple II, can you be sort of faking it out by like turning on modes that the Apple II doesn't respond to, but the VidHD does, so that the displayed screen can be actually different, like the two different screens can be different? That might be kind of a fun hack to try.
I think so, because all you're doing is writing to different memory addresses, the ones that do and do not exist on the two. That you're very quickly going to run into horsepower problems, though. Like, even with the super high-res thing, like the 2GS doesn't even have enough horsepower to push its own video memory, never mind an Apple II Plus. So you can kind of like gradually load a static image, and it's neat that you can do that. But yeah, you're not going to be making multi-screen games or anything like that on an Apple II Plus.
Yeah, I know on the demo, as you can see in the video, when the Apple IIgs display mode is active on the 2e, the main screen, the composite attached screen goes blank. But I don't know if that's programmatically done, or if it could have shown text. I don't know that. But as Quinn pointed out, the way the GS mode graphics are drawn is sending commands to memory addresses that don't exist. So maybe that doesn't mean that, it has to blank out. But then maybe the high-res screen is like a buffer. I don't know.
The trick is that I think the soft switches, like, somehow you have to get it, you have to hit the soft switches right so that they're meaningless to the 2 Plus, but it'll switch right. The mode on the 2GS.
Mm. Yeah, it has to be. Yeah, because the 2GS video memory is in a bank, right? The 2GS has 64 banks of memory, and the upper 8-bit bank part of the address doesn't exist on the memory bus physically. So there's more going on than just writing to memory addresses that the 2 Plus doesn't know about. So yeah, it must be the case that there's a soft switch that says, okay, all memory writes are now treated as being in bank E0, and so it looks like super high res. Otherwise, you'd just be stomping all over, Apple II memory. Right. So yeah, there must be more going on there than we know about.
Yeah, at some point, in all of the free time that I have, I will set this up and try it out and see if I can figure out some way to do it, to sort of like somehow fake out the VidHD.
All that free time.
Yeah.
And no doubt, John and 4AM and others are screaming at their podcast players about how we're getting all of this wrong.
Yeah. No doubt.
Well, then that's their fault for marketing it incorrectly.
Yes. Now I know how all of you feel talking about things that I understand when I'm not on the show. Right. It's hard. Okay.
You got sucked into the RCR vortex.
That's right. You start talking about things off the cuff and you're like, yeah, I think I know roughly how this works. And you start saying stuff and then it's just all wrong.
You start thinking, huh.
Okay. Let's see. I will briefly mention the one thing that is the still only one thing that is in our upcoming show roundup, which is the World of Commodore on December 5th. It is in some notional sense in Toronto, but it is actually online. And it is, did I say this already? Saturday, December 5th. So it's soon. It's very soon. Like, it might be in the past by the time you're listening to this, if you're not actually listening to us record it.
And I see that from the URL, it's hosted by TPUG, Toronto Pet User Group, who I have been aware of since I was in high school, but never been part of because, pet people. Why would I hang out with them? But a friend of mine, Derek, his dad was like one of the founders of TPUG. So that's how I first heard about it, was like in his driveway, him talking about the Pet User Group that his dad ran.
And mocking it.
No, at the time, like, weirdly, I pretend to have very strong opinions about like other computers suck, but at the time I was like, yeah, my friend has a different thing, let me go play your games. Nobody ever actually really cared about that stuff.
I pretended to care, but it was covering up jealousy because the Commodore people had way better games and I was secretly super jealous.
I'm going to interject here. I just asked on Slack, Jay Kraft, who built the text mode demos, what we were, if it's possible. Mm-hmm. He said, because of the way the graphics screens are synchronized, it's not possible to display graphics of any sort on the VidHD while displaying something on the composite screen. But you can display, say, high-resolution graphics on the composite monitor and do anything you want with the VidHD's recently added text modes that I talked about. So you could actually have text displaying on the VidHD in one of the text modes, but and graphics on the 2e, but not the other way around because of the way the system synchronizes memory. So
okay, so maybe opens up doors for a dual screen text adventure type game thing.
Yeah,
you could do something like that.
Although the screen that doesn't have the good graphics is the one showing the graphics. That, yeah, that's a shame.
That's cool.
Of course, there's, I think it's the 240, you know, character wide text mode on the VidHD is almost higher resolution than the 2E's HDR 280 screen.
Yeah, I was going to say, again, the 2 Plus is not going to have the horsepower to push that many text characters because that's as many pixels as it has, frankly. So it's hard to push that amount of text, honestly, at 1 megahertz.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to note that it has some degree of this capability. It sounds like Jay's listening. Yes, yep. You could absolutely have a split screen text adventure.
With the junky graphics on the real screen and nicely rendered text.
Well, no,
what
you do is on the graphic screen you render out the text, and on the great screen you do ASCII characters for like an amazing graphics.
There you go. That's what I'm saying. And of course, if you're, you know, you can also use this on a GS. You know, so the GS will do its GS mode.
Who's got one of those? Quinn.
Yeah. And then the text mode, but I don't know. It feels more fun to use this on a pre-GS too. Sort of.
I wonder if it's fast enough to flip back and forth so you could fake having two displays simultaneously, just be a little bit flickery.
Huh. Give yourself a seizure, yeah. That sounds like a...
I mean, if it's as fast as the page switching like in HDR, it's fast enough to animate with, so I don't know, maybe, but probably not. It probably has to sync to the HDMI display and stuff, so it's probably slow to switch. But
there must be some kind of a lag.
Yeah.
Great piece of hardware there.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'm really quite curious about how this other mode works. It sounds to me like there is a way to tell the VidHD I'm talking to you now, you know, in this kind of the same way that you talk to a real time clock chip. You send it like some sort of like magic sequence that says, "Okay, command follows."
Yeah.
Well, obviously there's a few people developing for this thing, and people have answers to those things, so.
And yet we still talk.
Yeah, we're just talking. We still don't know anything about it, but we're still talking about it like we do. Yeah.
Maybe we should, you know, get one of these folks to join us one show.
Yeah, we should get John on the show to talk about it.
Okay, let's see. Let us move on. Where were we? Oh, I think we had briefly gone to the upcoming show roundup and then circled back to VidHD.
Yeah.
That's right. I remember now. Yeah. Okay, and now a word from our sponsor.
The revolutionary new Timex Data Link Watch uses light beams to transfer dates and data from your computer to your wrist with just a touch of your paw. Pretty smart, eh? The Timex Data Link Watch.
Buzz Aldrin,
Gordon Cooper,
Scott Carpenter.
We'd like to compare notes with Stevie on the new space station.
Hello?
Hi, Tommy Lasorda for Stevie.
Hey, what's up?
Just a question about moving Randolph to the number 2 position.
Yeah, second, and this'll work. It's perfect.
Hi.
Hey.
We're the Pointer Sisters.
Stevie's expecting us.
Well, come in.
We need help with our new album.
The Amiga. Color, sound, graphics, power. At a price to make it truly the computer for the creative mind.
Can you hear me, Steve?
What can the Amiga do? Well, what do you want it to do?
Mr. O'Neill! Stevie is upstairs, but it's kind of crowded. Would you like some fried chicken while you're waiting?
Can you hear me?
Amiga from Commodore. The computer for the creative mind.
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea is something I think that Carrington found. It is it's a website.
Oh, right, yes.
Yes. So it is Susan Kerr Prince from kerrprince.com, and there are several interesting ones to choose from. Collections of icons, 1984 A to Z on gray is the one of the first ones that looks pretty tempting.
These are great. I love that. I love the little Steve Jobs. Look at that.
Yeah, you get full size ones of each. They're all limited editions of either 200 or 100 items of various sizes. Some come in color, some are black and white. But like, if you're a fan of old Macs, like Susan Kerr, so like her stuff, her graphics just like can define that. They're one and the same to me. So if you're a fan of that, and these would be the kind of things, it'd be easy to, you know, knock off your own one or whatever, but it's nice to support mm-hmm. somebody who had such a huge impact on something I loved as a kid and love now. Like it just carries through, but just getting a big old happy Mac or sad Mac that you can flip back and forth depending on your mood or something. I can see digging that.
I'm amazed she has the rights to sell prints of this stuff, because surely Apple owns all of that.
I would have thought so too.
Huh. Maybe she has something in her contract going all the way back that says she's allowed to reuse these icons.
But you get the Moof, like get the dog cow. Like there's lots of like iconic things.
Yeah, I love these.
Yeah, these are really, really pretty interesting. I was the one that kind of caught my attention first was the control panel. Actually, there's something that I really just kind of like about the sort of whatever that is, System 6, System 5 era.
Yeah, it's control panel. It's so friendly and felt like the future to such a degree. Like it was just I loved it because it's much more like graphical. Like GUIs have sort of drifted away from this look. You know, this, it's got a little bit of that, you know, verisimilitude, a little bit of that skeuomorphism, but like now control panels are a lot more just like it's a grid of icons or it's a list of text items, you know, but this is very like almost trying to look like a hi-fi control panel kind of thing. Like, I know it's got more personality than GUIs ended up having after 20 years.
It looks like most of these prints are about $129.
Only if you get
approximately $129.
That's for the like letter size ones. If you go up to the really big ones, like 30 by 40 inches, then it's normally around $500.
Yes, that's true. Not quite $500.
Art don't come cheap, babe.
And the skull actually has the Apple logo in it. How is she getting away with that one?
Susan Kerr can do what she wants.
Apparently.
Yeah.
That's she's some kind of baller. I don't know. We've underestimated this woman. Look at that. I'd get sued just for having that on my website.
We're all going to be sued for just looking at it. We are currently broadcasting it on YouTube.
That's right. True.
Awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, there's one of the things, I don't know if she still sells it, one of the things I've got framed in my office in D.C., which theoretically I'll be seeing again at some point, is she has a bandana that had black and white that, you know, with some of the different icons, kind of interesting look. But yeah, the cloth items are pretty cool.
I love the dog cow ones. I always love that. I always love to move.
Yeah. There's just something that's exactly the right amount of random in that.
Yeah.
It's not insane, but it is ridiculous.
Every pixel is just in the exact right place. Like there's just something about her art. Mm-hmm.
And something about that dog cow.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, okay, so that's the current retro computing gift idea. And now I guess when you're done deciding which of those to buy, we will head over to eBay and
buy more things.
Yeah, so it looks like, Blake, your list is empty. So
no, I actually have... I have some items that I'm not. Oh, I didn't populate it. I actually have a couple items. So one of them is the, and actually this one has sold. I'm afraid I didn't quite realize how close we were, but it's a batch of three Apple IIe workstation cards, and it is fully, you know, rather densely populated card for the two with a little breakout box on the back that has the Apple, I guess, RS422 or Apple Talk, I guess, the Apple Talk network connections. And it actually has a serial port for the for a direct printer connection.
So how much did that sell for?
Just $152 for all three of them.
That is insane.
That is so low. It's crazy. Somebody got a steal.
So if you had a vintage, you know, if you had a like some kind of a, you know, a Mac that has a Apple Talk port, you can serve files to your 2E or 2GS.
The joys of Apple Share.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually did just talk about that. Like one of those came up, I think, on the previous one, but that was just one of them.
Yeah.
And they seem, you know, functional, and they look you know, clean. Each one has the proper cables and the breakout box. I'm very impressed. And actually, it looks like there's additional cabling.
Yeah, those are the little phone net adapter thingies to set up your AppleTalk network. This is a crazy low price, like just insane.
Is that all three cards for that price?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my right.
14 wow. bits. How do we not? Yeah, what, so rare. Why did we not see it? Was it listed? Why did?
And how did it
this?
Have 14 bidders and only go that high? Who are the 13 yeah. people that checked out at $150?
When I saw it, I didn't. You know, it wasn't. It was nearly over, I guess, but it wasn't over, and it didn't occur to me. I mean, I assumed that it was going to go, you know, hundreds of dollars. But no, wow.
Well, it's going to be when that person relists them all separately.
Or relists two of them for starting yeah. to 200 each. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. I wonder so is it in the wrong category? What happened?
Yeah,
how did none of our search terms find this?
Vintage computing, vintage parts and accessories.
Yeah. Paul's got six separate alerts that should have gone off.
Did they spell Apple workstation and card all separate? Right.
Is it? Apple IIe workstation cards, comma cables.
Yeah. I was wondering if it maybe was like LLE, but even that would have – I have a workstation search, and I didn't see this.
Not a good enough one, apparently.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have, you know, bought it myself, but still, this is – somebody really – congratulations, you.
Yes.
Whoever indeed. You are.
Yeah, yeah.
And scored.
And also, so just kind of related to this, and I was talking offline with Paul about this. Paul actually knows the individual as well as the project much better. I think this is something that was demonstrated at Kansas Fest, but
Ivan X, yeah.
Yeah, Ivan X.
Yeah, Ivan Drucker.
Ivan Drucker, he was able to make the proper physical connections and software connections in order to, you know, start actually booting, you know, a 2E from a Protoss volume from a Macintosh. But then he took it further and, you know, set up a NAS to, you know, do that in a standalone fashion. And finally, I believe that the Raspberry Pi was the, you know, was the final host, and it was able to boot, I think, both GSOS for GS and Protoss for an Apple II. But anyway, that's a use case for these cards. And I actually wasn't familiar with Ivan's work here, but I just wanted to tack that on.
I have a fun ongoing thing where I bug Ivan about I cannot understand the difference between A2 server and A2 cloud. And I've been basically asking him what the difference is and to explain it to me for years now every time I see him. Right. It's great. I'm sure he's enjoyed it as much as I have.
I'm sure.
I've enjoyed it. I've been present for many of those conversations as well.
Like, wait, okay, which one is which? Yes, I seriously can't keep it straight in my head, so I'm just making it a bit. It's been great.
Yeah, but it is worth noting that system also, it predates like all of the SD card solutions and all of the other, like it was the OG way to get modern software into your Apple II.
Totally.
Like, it was a shared network drive before we had any other way to do it besides like burning floppies, you know, via what's it called? The ADT Pro.
And as you can see from the auction, there are a dime a dozen, so go grab some.
Apparently, yeah, they're just giving them away now.
It's but anyway, that caught my attention. And one quick last thing. This is just a breeze through here. I saw an auction for Vintage Software Adventure Apolisa Macintosh 128K Wizardry sealed.
I didn't know Wizardry came out for Lisa.
Well, that's the thing, and that's kind of what got me here. So it's a new in package, unopened Wizardry and Wizard for the Mac. Sure, you know, that's fine. I didn't realize that it was, yeah, that's the thing. Out for the Lisa, it says the label says 128K, 512K Mac or Lisa.
Cool. So it's really just a sticker. Is
right.
What this is.
Yeah, I contacted the person, and this was, I believe, I think I went through Reddit and found this, not in my actual search for the show. So I asked the individual who had posted it, and he said that it, you know, if he claimed that I could look online, do the you know, logical search for, you know, Macintosh Wizardry, and I would be able to find a screenshot or two of it running on the Lisa. I asked if he had a screenshot or if he had seen it. And I did this and I couldn't find it. I couldn't find anything that looked like you know, even a Mac XL as far as like tall pixels or something, or, you know, wider desktop. So I don't know if it runs on the Lisa natively, that makes it pretty interesting to me. I would be curious to find it for my Lisa 2. But I don't know. What are your thoughts? You're about to say something, Quinn.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the Lisa, but is it the case that the Lisa will just run Mac software? Because this really appears to just be a Mac version of this game, and they put Mac or Lisa on the sticker, in which case this is a $300 sticker.
Not unless it's been turned into a Macintosh XL. Then it doesn't run Lisa software, and it runs Macintosh software slowly and with the wrong aspect ratio unless you do a video modification.
Also, that's not necessarily an exclusive or. Yes, it runs on Mac or Lisa. It runs on Mac.
Yeah, but you call Mac. It, but your Lisa is called a Mac XL after that, technically. So and Apple sold a Mac. They sold a product that was the Mac XL after it stopped being the Lisa. But it was.
But then what's in this box? Are there two different floppies, one for Mac, one for Lisa? Because it says Mac or Lisa.
Well, there's one way to find out.
You can or you just don't know which one you're getting. They just put a random disk in every box.
And actually, this one ended. It looks like this one ended 9 minutes ago or something. So whoops, sorry guys, but they were asking $299 for it. So we could have found out for $300 and $10 shipping.
I think someone just bought a $300 sticker. There's something fishy here. I don't know that I believe that anyone wrote a Lisa specific version of any game.
I've certainly never heard of it.
I'm looking at this message. The guy I contacted said, no, sorry. I just packed the Lisa away a couple of weeks ago. If you search on quote wizardry on Macintosh quote, you'll find some images.
Macintosh, sure.
Lisa looks slightly different as the pixels are different, but very close. But that sounds like Macintosh XL, which runs Mac software.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's sort of like just booting Pascal on your Apple II or whatever. I mean, it's just the software, right? I mean, the piece of hardware is the same, whether you're running Lisa 7.7 or Mac XL or, you know, whatever you call that workbench. What is it? What is the thing?
Lisa Office System. Yeah, the operating system is called the Lisa Office System, I believe.
The
Macintosh,
Macintosh,
whatever that thing. Yeah, I guess you're right. Can they? Is it? I was thinking that it had to have a ROM modification.
I don't think so.
Oh, if that's the case, if you could just boot it with a disk, then okay, then sure. I thought it necessarily required a completely different ROM set.
Yeah, you can do the video aspect ratio thing if you want.
Yes.
Because actually, running the Mac, because I have a Lisa 2 that I've run both on, actually, now that I think about it. And if you run the Mac stuff on that Lisa 2 without the video modification, everything is comically narrow. but otherwise, I mean, it's still, you know, it still looks like a Mac when it's running a Mac and looks like a Lisa when it's running a Lisa.
So based on all of this, I still think that's just the Mac version, and they put a Mac or Lisa sticker on it because someone in marketing figured out that it will technically run on a Lisa too.
Yep, I think that is
that's
probably
my guess.
Correct.
Someone just paid $300 for a Mac version of Wizardry.
I can't say, and I've lamented this to you in years past, Paul, but yes, I can't say that I use the Lisa 2 with any remote frequency, but I've never used it with anything that wasn't, you know, specific for the Lisa. So I didn't even, that's something I'll have to look into, actually. Sounds like a new thing to chase.
Yeah, I think I booted it. I forget exactly what I did. I didn't get very far, though. I booted something, you know, in the I wish I could remember the name of the software environment that you have to boot to make it be a Mac. But it very quickly, you know, gave me a bomb. So it was acting exactly like a Mac.
Yeah, it's a Mac then, yeah.
Susan Kerr will sell your print of that bomb.
Exactly.
Yeah. MacWorks XL?
That's it. That is, in fact, the thing I was trying to remember. MacWorks.
So, yeah, there's some YouTube videos of, you know, demonstration. Okay. Well, that's all I got.
Excellent. I mean, not... Okay. and now, I guess, Carrington has the next set.
I picked three games, one I loved, one I have comments about, and one I'm very surprised exists. The one I loved was Hellcats Over the Pacific. What I like about this game is seeing the box. I played a lot of this game. I never saw this box before. so it's buy it now for $25, which is pretty good. And this was, if you've never played it, was an absolutely fantastic game for early Macs, like early. It says on it, like you can't run it on the Mac Plus or whatever.
But or the Lisa 2.
LC, Mac 2, like that early color games, Quadric, something, just a great game. So these sort of graphics are blocky 3D graphics, but it's really smooth. You fly around, you shoot things. Even a not great gamer like me, I could last kind of long shooting down zeros. It was super fun. And it's really neat to see a game in a box. This had a box. I'm still surprised by that. So I probably owe somebody at least $25 for this, for how often I played this game and only had a copied version or a copied version of it. It's anyway, fantastic game. If you're a collector of early Mac games, highly recommend this one. So this is my first choice. Did any of you guys play this on early Mac games? Did you have the same experience?
No.
Every time I mention this game, no one's ever heard of it. So I think there was this copy. I probably had a duplicate of this one box. It sold nothing. Yeah. I don't know why, because it's absolutely fantastic. Great, great game. Anyway, like that game. It's the only flight simulator of any sort I've ever liked or been even remotely good at, it because it's super forgiving. It's just point your joystick and you shoot and you just fly and it's awesome. And then you crash when you try to land, but whatever. That's flight simulator. So that's my first choice. $25, certainly worth it for buy it now, including the box. Second one, Starfighter for the Mac PowerPC by Studio 3DO. What caught my eye was it's a 3DO game.
What?
So 3DO, most people will know them as the company that put out the 3DO, but they were also a game studio that then I think got destroyed by putting out the 3DO. So it's so rare you see anything with their logo on it that's not the actual 3DO. But this is a Mac and PC game called Starfighter. I have never heard of this thing before. Also a 3D flying thing, so it kind of keeps the theme alive. But it's neat because it's a 3DO game. How often do you ever encounter anything with this logo on it, baby? So
3DO game. I can actually date that for you a little bit because I worked at 3DO and...
I did not know that. I knew about Bungie.
So, cool. And this is their original logo. So this is during the hardware era. So the company started out as a hardware console company, like a lot of people know, and then they added a software arm, and then the hardware arm failed, and then the software arm morphed into 3DO, period, and they changed the logo. And then that last generation of 3DO I joined just before that. So they had just killed, they had the second generation console was in development when I joined, and they were just on the verge of killing it. And that's when they changed the logo, and then they started making PS2 games and just, you know, games for other consoles.
The PS2 games I've seen, but I hadn't encountered a Mac or PC game. That's interesting, though. I thought the software existed first, and then they went into the console, which then didn't make it, and then they kept going with software. So that's really interesting.
The name actually comes from the name of the console. They wanted it to be a set-top box in your living room that, you know, like everybody wanted to say their game console to be your generic set-top box. So the idea was the name is supposed to be like audio, video, 3DO. So the idea was it was supposed to be a generic 3D graphics box that you would put in your home and it would do 3D graphics things. It was a very strange vision.
I don't think that was intuitive.
No, not at all. The name.
I didn't know that either. That's so cool. Yeah. I'm so glad I picked this now. I'm learning so much about 3DO.
Yeah, we wasted a lot of time explaining the name of the company to people because people did not get that like joke, or for lack of a better term, at all. But the first gen console was actually just okay. But the second gen one, it was called the M2, was the code name for it. And I actually had one on my desk for a little while.
Wait, did that come out?
No, it never did.
Oh,
it was killed.
Oh, I understand that. It never got released, right. Yeah, but that was, wasn't it supposed to be like really amazing though?
It was astonishing hardware. It really was. It was like somewhere between PS2 and PS3 level of horsepower, but pre-PS2. So it was like a generation or a generation and a half ahead of everything else at the time. But it was going to be, they couldn't get the price point down was the problem. Much like the original 3DO, like the price point was too high for a game console and not high enough for like luxury electronics, and or the luxury electronics market didn't want a game system. So they couldn't get the price point down, and the M2 was even worse. But it was amazing hardware for sure.
I remember I subscribed to Edge magazine at the time. Not Edge, Next Generation magazine at the time. I think they're related. And I remember back in, I guess, it was my first apartment, like 1996, following the news of the development of the M2. Like the M2 was crazy anticipated. I think I'm conflating it with the Nuon hardware, I think, which was a similar concept. It sounds less powerful, I think. But I was going to say, Jeff, do you remember, did Jeff Minter work on some conceptual software demos for the M2? Or I know he wrote a lot of games for the new one. Maybe I'm completely conflating those two.
I don't know that. So they did actually make PC games and stuff as well. Like Heroes and Might and Magic came out on PC as well during and post the hardware phase. But one of the cool things about 3DO is that it was Trip Hawkins' second enterprise after EA, and he brought a lot of EA people with him, and he also brought a lot of old Atari people with him when he started it. So I actually worked there at the same time as Rob Zadibble and Howard Scott Warshaw, and Bill Budge was there. Todd, the Pac-Man guy, I forgot your last name. I went to his Christmas party. Anyway, the guy who made $250,000 on Pac-Man for the 2600. That guy had some stories.
Todd Fry.
Todd Fry, thank you. So they were all there. So, I mean, it was a terrible company, but it was a great experience because of all the people I got to work with, which was a lot of fun. So, yeah.
It's funny, with the original 3DO, I never had any interest in it, but me and a bunch of people all started talking about the next gen one coming. Like, everybody had huge, everyone said that's going to be the thing. Like, it was, and then it just never came out. I was like, oh, but all of us were anticipating the like crazy, the second generation 3DO. It was supposed to be like the thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was doing reflection mapping and rendered texture and per pixel lighting. I mean, stuff that, you know, even the PS3 didn't have on initially. Like, it was crazy, the stuff you could do on it. But yeah, I mean, it was going to cost $1,000 when it came out, and no one was ever going to pay that for a game console.
Whereas this game is $15, still sealed. So if you're a 3DO fan or whatever, a collector, I mean, how do you beat $15 still sealed game? So. Cost more for shipping.
Pretty cool.
Yep. So that was my second choice. Caught my eye because 3DO game for the Mac. Don't see a lot of those. And my third one is, a seller currently has listed a ton of baggy software for the Tandy Coco. And I love the Coco because I had a Coco and it's so fun. And I love software that came in baggies. So these are a bunch of Sundog system games. I picked this one, but there's a whole bunch of them available right now on eBay for buy it now is of anywhere from $40 to $65. This is one of the more expensive ones. And what caught my eye was, it's Sinistar, although spelled with two A's for copyright stuff, but a version of Sinistar for the Coco. It's like, how's that work? So, okay. Takes two discs, but it's Sinistar. You can look at the graphics. It's clearly a version of Sinistar that originally sold for
$34.95. So it is related to the arcade game.
Yeah, Sinistar, which is a difficult game to make, I would assume. One of the things about the Coco, and why I picked this one in particular, is the Coco I had, I really liked it, though I had an original Coco, and I had the worst joystick I've ever touched, let alone owned. There was a joystick that I had that was just shockingly bad from Radio Shack, where it was a little tiny metal stick, and it just would, like, it had no feet, so you just flop it around anywhere. It felt just like there was nothing. Which would be great for Sinistar, because it wants that like 64 location joystick. So maybe this is the ultimate game that Tandy always hoped would come out for the Coco. I don't know. But if you have a 512K Coco 3, then this might be the game for you. But this seller currently has dumped a ton of baggy Coco 3 software. So if you're a Coco 3 gamer, now's the time to head on to eBay.
I do love that they just added an A to the name. You would never get away with that today. Like, if you put out a computer that was Macintosh with a K, like, you would be sued into oblivion instantly.
It's a Nintendo.
In the 80s. Good enough.
Yeah, good enough. So I love baggy software, and this person's selling a ton of them, but the Sinistar caught my eye because it's the audacity of making a version of Sinistar, very difficult, fast-moving arcade game, make it for Coco 3. Love it. Mm-hmm. That's it. Those are my three choices. Three games. Buy them all. Paul, buy them all. Also buy a Coco so that you can play that one. Mm-hmm. Was there?
That's it. Nice. There's a nice video of the Sinistar on YouTube for the Coco 3.
Yeah, but does it look good?
Yeah, it looks pretty good.
Okay. Well, Paul, see? Looks pretty good. Yeah. You should buy it.
Excellent. Yeah. It seems like as good a place as any to just start with my Coco adventures.
Exactly. Yeah. Who's next?
Okay. I guess I am next.
Oh my God, you got 35 choices.
Well, I'm going to skip some.
Okay.
First one, though, I'll just stick with the things that are relevant or related to things we talked about before. The first one is Lisa 210.
And Blue Wizardry.
Yeah, if you're lucky. It is just to buy it now for just a little under $3,000. So there's no auction or anything like that. I can't decide. It's a little tricky to think about the price of these things, because there's a sense in which when you think about this stuff, you tend to cheap out because, you know, I don't want to pay that much for something that's old. But at the same time, this is in just great condition. It's all very clean. The screen works. It's got a nice little sort of mesh thing over the screen. The keyboard's clean.
Is this the original color? Or is that uniformly yellowed?
It's pretty close to the original color. Okay.
Yeah. But it does look pretty uniform. Don't take those stickers off. or you will learn.
Is this a good price for Elisa? I don't know anything about the market for them.
I purchased Elisa 2 from a guy. It wasn't eBay. I think it was on one of the mailing lists or Usenet or something. But he had a few Elisa 2s he had refurbished. So it was perfect condition, clean, no yellowing, all the cables, dust free, has the mesh, screen worked, and he had cleaned it out. I mean, it didn't have a speck of dust. You know, like the guy had cleaned it out. It was $1,100 delivered, and that was in 2006. $1,100 delivered. So, that to me felt like a pretty good price for a perfect condition Elisa 2. It's a 210, by the way. It has the hard drive. It's exactly this model, Elisa 210. That felt very reasonable to me. I don't know. It looks really good. This one looks very good condition. It might feel slightly high to me.
Yeah.
Have we said yet for anyone listening, it's $3,000 is the price on this one?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if we did.
That's a lot of money for a retro computer, but I mean, I don't know what these go for. So.
Well, and the other thing is
to Canada, so don't have to worry about it.
It's the thing about these is that, there aren't many of them. The ones that there are don't generally look that nice. Or work. I think I could sort of see saying, even if that's kind of a lot, it's not a lot relative to like buying a regular computer, it's possible that might just be worth it to not have to sort of, dink around with it. But, this is the version that does not have the battery, so you don't have to worry about the battery having corroded anything. The only place this machine actually says Lisa is in the corner of the CPU board, which is kind of funny about that.
Sadly, the original Lisa, it lacks that awesome original Lisa nameplate, that the Elisa 2, for whatever reason, didn't have. Of course, at some point, the thing with these is... I don't hear so much about capacitors. I mean, they're obviously old, but this keyboard, you have to replace all the mechanisms in time because it's foam, which degrades. Yeah, it's like our System Saver, System Saver GS. If you've had one, that strip turns into nasty, nasty.
Mm-hmm.
Every key, the foam turns into nasty, nasty, and you have to then replace it with new foam, and it's mine hasn't done that yet, but it's just I'm sure if I actually sat down and typed for like an hour, I would start feeling it. Yeah,
I'm surprised on such a high end computer they used such a crappy keyboard technology.
I mean, it feels okay, but yeah, the tech behind it is weird. It's like foam plus a dome.
Classic foam dome.
Yeah. Interact poorly, but I think it feels pretty good.
Yeah. I have I have a bag full of these replacement foam discs that I have to, and I have only one of the Lisa bodies, but I have like three or four keyboards. So
I wish we named our episodes. We'd totally call this one Foam Dome. It'd be great.
We still could.
I'm sure you could sell some of those keyboards for decent money.
Yeah, I'm going to manufacture replacement parts for these things. I'm going to call it the home of the Foam Dome.
That's fantastic.
Slogan writes itself.
I will say that the guy was going to, he made me, he was going to charge me $300 for original Lisa mouse. He gave me a Mac mouse, which works with it, but he was going to give $300. I found, like, I bought elsewhere, like $100 for the Lisa mouse, that more square one. But you see those now for like $1,000, you know.
Yeah, those are very hard.
Are they made of foam?
I don't think there's any foam in that mouse.
I'm not convinced that original Lisa mouse really came with the Lisa 2. I mean, I think they certainly came with the Lisa 1, but I'm not sure about the Lisa 2. But, okay.
Oh, anyway. Paul, before you go on to the next thing, in the chat, Curtis Boyle was asking if a guy named Glenn Dahlgren was selling those Coco software to talk about, because he was the guy behind Sundog. And yes, that is the name of the person on eBay selling it. So I guess it's the fellow behind the actual that company, Sundog, that made all these software titles.
So he's selling his own leftover stock.
Things.
Oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. That is...
Huh.
I will say, Carrington, as we've been sitting here talking, I've got the Sinistar video still playing. It looks pretty amazing on the Coco 3, actually. It's like shaded 3D meteors. It's quite impressive.
Yeah. Anyway, he's the guy, that Glenn is the fellow selling all these. There's lots of adventure games, like a whole bunch of baggy software for the Coco. I love baggy software.
Those discs are in great condition. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Like the blue hasn't worn
minimally
through
the labels.
Or he just printed up some new ones. His right two.
Three sides at least.
Oh, yeah, those are nice. I didn't know the Coco 3 was capable of such nice graphics.
Yeah, it requires 512K, which is not stock. The Coco had like 320 by 200 by 16 out of 64 palette, which, you know, not too bad.
Anyway, that was it. Just wanted to revert back and say, yep, yes, it is. And well spotted in the chat.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, let's see. My next one, I won't dwell too long on this, but you know, with the theme of the sort of like paper input, this is a Sankyo music punch card thing. So it's not even computer related, but it is, it's still sort of like punch related. It's actually maybe a little bit more like player piano related. But you get a little strip. It comes with some pre-punched strips with some pre-made songs that you feed into your Sankyo computer music reader, and there's also, I think, some instructions on how you can make your own. Looks like those are D batteries it takes. That's pretty excellent. Punch and play, fun for everyone, computer music. And I think really the computer part is, you know, that people thought paper tapes and punch cards, you know, that was computers. So
the punch cards that come with it, most of them are empty, but some of them in that photo are filled in with music that looks really complicated.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you need a computer to play it.
Apparently.
That's right. But anyway, it seemed kind of cool. So if you were looking for a slightly different sort of punch tape. Okay, let's see. This is the auction that I showed earlier, but it's the 12 issues of Interface Age that may or may not have flexi discs in them. But at least you can read about the word processor on the discs. I did try to look at the auction to see, like, you know, can you see, is there a flexi disc inside the pages, because they have a side on shot.
But a page looks like got a gap or something.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm pretty sure I do have at least one issue of this magazine with the flexi disc in it, but not handy right now, so I can't really check where it is in the magazine. But anyway, $32, buy it now. It's still available, I think. Reload, yes. Okay.
Nice little collection there.
Okay, so this I thought was pretty interesting. This is a Timex Datalink 150. So we might have talked about these before, but essentially the thing about these is that it's like a data watch, an early data watch. I think it was 1994 or something like that. And the way it worked is that you would send data to it through pulsing, the pulses that were picked up by a little sensor. And so you'd hold it up to your CRT and it would sort of like signal it. And these are fairly expensive to get. This particular one, it kind of seems like this person doesn't exactly know what
they have here. But so this is $30. It doesn't work because the guy tried to take the back off and couldn't get it back on. So the battery died, tried to replace the battery. The back came off and can't figure out how to put it back together. So selling it for $30.
Somebody should buy this. That's a steal. Yeah, because I'm sure that's fixable.
Yeah,
I remember these. You programmed it by holding it up to your computer and it would flash the entire screen white and black to program the data. There's a little photo sensor right above the LCD there on the front of the watch.
It's Timex and Microsoft co-branded. But yeah, so if you wanted to just risk it, do I? Maybe I do.
Paul's selling Paul stuff.
Yeah. Another thing that's kind of cool is that Timex.com, in fact, still has this software for it.
Wow, look at that. That's fantastic.
So
if you keeps on taking.
Yeah, Windows 3.1, look at that. Oh, it runs all the way Windows up to 2000. NT. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Huh.
And it doesn't work. Let's see. It doesn't work for. It doesn't work with LCD monitors, and it doesn't work with Apple computers.
Sort of like the guns for Nintendo things. So it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it's just flashing blocks of color on the screen, but the timing is probably such that LCDs don't work.
Right. Yeah.
Like you said, there might be a synchronization pulse at the start or something like that that gets lost on an LCD.
Mm. They actually sold a little like a dongle for if you had a laptop, like a PC laptop, you could. It was essentially just like a little light on a wire that you would put the thing in. So it would pretend to be a monitor, but displaying only, essentially it's displaying the same thing as that TV show, right?
Yeah. The flashing dot. Yeah.
I'm sure it's the same engineer behind those two technologies.
Yeah.
The guy from the BBC.
Okay. Yeah. So the next thing I thought it was sort of interesting. You can get a metal sign I was trying to track down actually, you know, this logo thing that we have. Like, I didn't know where it came from. So it took me a little, I did a little bit of effort to discover that the graphic that has been used forever, basically on the RCR, is this UNIVAC ad. Huh. You're trying to divide by zero.
Interesting.
So you can get them this metal sign if you want. I don't think I will, but you could. $20 is not too much.
It's cool to know where the RCR logo comes from. I never knew what it was.
Yeah. You can also get a poster version of it. And in fact, you can get a poster version of it that is 63 by 47 inches and two panels.
Oh my goodness.
You can see what that looks like over a couch.
Great backdrop behind us. You can also just take a screenshot of the website.
You could do that. It was neat to learn yesterday where this graphic came from. It's possible that I knew at one point, but mostly this is all, it's all David, right? So, okay, let's see. How are we doing? What's the next one? I thought this was kind of interesting. This is a Kazen Apple software library or sampler library, and it's for that Kazen soft strip system. And I think it actually just came with it. Like, you know, this is sort of a soft strip system that has been parted out, but anyway, so this is just the manual. There's not the hardware, but if you had the hardware, you could use this to read in a mortgage calculator or, you know, whatever, triangles. Yeah, I see. Actually, it does seem to have like some things that were taken from Nibble and some things that were taken from other places. Tim Hartnell, who I guess probably wrote a book.
I feel like every Apple II resource ever involved a mortgage calculator at some point as one of its little programs. Yep. And I always wonder, did anyone ever use one of those to calculate their mortgage?
And realize that they shouldn't have bought that Apple II.
That's right.
For whatever reason, the thing that stands out to me, and I noticed it yesterday in an old A-plus magazine, whenever I see like an office suite of software for one of these old systems in the mags, the thing that stands out to me is always accounts receivable.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I guess every business, people don't really, I guess, need that at home. But it's. I wish I knew how many accounts receivable applications were written for the Apple II.
That nobody ever used.
Many. Right. Anyway, okay. So so that's mine. I think I will leave it at that since I'm not last.
All right, I guess that means I'm up. So we talked recently on another podcast, which is new that you should all listen to, by a friend of the show, Charles Mangan, called Chicken Missile, which is a shout out to our annual K-Fest super podcast. Yep. And we talked about aspirations involving the letter A, and one of mine was to someday acquire an Amiga. And so just for fun today, I was looking at them on eBay, and I'm sure Blake will have much more information about this than me, because I know nothing about the Amiga market, but I learned a few things just in some casual scanning here. So first thing I looked at was Amiga 500s, and I learned that there are plenty of them, and they are not very expensive. I found one in box because I thought that would be a cool experience. If I'm going to do this, then I would want to have as much of the original experience as possible. This poor box looks like it's been driven over by a truck, but the machine inside
does possibly set on fire at one point.
Yeah, but the machine inside does seem to be in decent shape. It is used. I think they would like it to perhaps appear in box new, but you can tell in the pictures that it's, you know, it's dirty. It's been used. I thought the price was pretty reasonable, $375. Seems to be complete. There aren't a lot of pictures as far as what else is included, if anything. It just has the power supply and the computer, so I don't know if there's discs or anything involved as well. But from my scanning of eBay right now for Amiga 500s, this seemed sort of typical. So,
but no pictures of it connected and working, though.
Right, so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it says sold as is. So, says when turned on, I get flashes of red, which might be an error of some sort.
Not the computer, just he's like, yeah. I'm so angry.
There are color codes that flash, and that sounds like it has some sort of problem, actually.
Okay.
It could just be it needs the drop 3 inches treatment.
Okay, so this may be a cautionary tale. Okay, so the second one that I found was a little more appealing. So this is actually cheaper, and it comes with the A500 HD 120 megabyte hard drive, which is quite cool. This is what we would call in the car business tastefully modified. It's got some nice kind of expansion. It's got 2 megabyte RAM, and it's got this nice little hard drive attachment that I actually really liked this thing. It's got a little power switch on there, and it looks like a nice little unit. So I feel like if you were going to get an Amiga 500, this might be a really good choice. And yeah, the price is right. And it's got some pictures of the inside. It's got what looks like a RAM expansion there. Looks like it's got an updated ROM from Amiga Forever. So again, tastefully modified and $350. So quite reasonable, this one.
That looks like a very nice one. I think for the money, that's a good buy. That's a SCSI hard drive controller.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so you could replace that with a SCSI to HD or something like that, or just use the spinning disk. But yeah, that's a very nice one.
What is this? There's a photo that one. What is that? It seems to be something like a little bit more modern looking board and a couple of cables.
This looks like a video converter. I see like VGA outputs on it, maybe.
Is that part of this package or is that a mistake?
It is, apparently.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
If it's part of the package, then it's what it is a scan doubler. Which it changes the 15 kilohertz to.
That was like a big SCART cable almost.
That's the standard Amiga.
Is it?
The Amiga.
Holy moly.
Yeah, it's like a DB20.
They were serious. Videos coming in hot.
If that's a scan doubler, then that's, you know, taking it to VGA, even though it's not taking it to HDMI, but if it's going to VGA, that gives you a great, you know, great deal more options than just a 15 kilohertz display.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is that none of these come with a monitor. And I know that the, like all 16-bit computers, the Amiga video standard is a weird custom thing. And so you kind of need the monitor, right? So maybe this thing you can get away with VGA.
Actually, like the Atari ST, the Amiga, and the 2GS, like you can, any of those monitors will interchange with any of the other ones. It's just a matter of the right cable.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I wired an Atari ST monitor to a, like an Acorn Archimedes, and I've used a GS monitor on my Amiga before with different cables.
I actually did not know that. Yeah, I knew that they're all loosely based on the arcade video standard, the 15 kilohertz arcade standard, but I wasn't sure how interchangeable they really were, so that's cool to know.
People are always doing that because of the scarcity of different ones.
Right.
And oddly, the Atari ST has like a high voltage cable in there you got to watch out for, because it has to know whether you're using the monochrome or the color monitor, because there were two. Different resolutions. Anyway, not to skew tangentially too far off.
So this, this seems like a good buy, and it seems cosmetically in great shape as well. So that's kind of cool. So the other thing I thought I'd look at is Amiga 1200s, because I feel like if a person is going to buy one and only one, either the 500 or the 1200 both seem like strong choices to me. The 1200 market seems to be very different. They seem to be a lot harder to come by. There was only two on eBay currently, and they are much more expensive. So, So this is one in the UK. So it's presumably PAL, 1,000 British pounds. Does come in the box, and it's got quite a number of accessories and things. But it appears to have been retrobrighted to me. I don't believe that's the original color. It's either very clean or it's photographed with lousy white balance and has been retrobrighted. I'm not sure which.
Well, it looks like it had the word Amiga on it really large, but it's all washed out.
Yeah, it's embossed.
The watermark.
I see. Okay.
I mean, it's like a plastic watermark. It's depressed.
Yeah, it's embossed in the plastic. But the fact that the Commodore logo is the colors missing in the photo, it strikes me as suspicious. So I don't know if
actually silver on the 1200.
Is it? Oh, interesting.
Micro horizontal lines that give it a little bit of a sheen.
Okay.
Textured. Yeah, that's silver.
That's cool. Now, this one does also come with some cool accessories. It's got a compact flash adapter here. It looks like it's internal. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of cool. And some other things as well. Looks like it's got custom ROMs as well. So this one's got some nice upgrades, but it's awfully spendy, £1,000, plus shipping international, plus it's probably going to be PAL when it gets here. So this would be not a great purchase for North America. But
I will say on the ROMs, that's the resultant ROM from like within the last, 18 months or something. Someone, I don't know how the legality of it worked, but they took the latest Amiga operating system and patched it up to more recent version, like improved it in several ways.
Okay.
And you could get ROMs burnt. This has those. So that's kind of a big thing. That's a very nice thing.
Now, Amiga Forever, correct me if I'm wrong, that's the company that actually bought all of the Amiga IP, right? And they still sell it as like a packaged CD?
Well, Amiga Forever, if I'm aware of the current lay of the land, they own the rights to the ROMs.
Right.
To the Amiga operating system, the ROMs. There's still some sort of a difference between Amiga Incorporated, as I understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, Amiga Incorporated is releasing like Amiga OS 4.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's had so many transitions, but I know the ROMs, if you want ROMs, you buy them from, as I most recently understood, Amiga right. Forever is the one you go to.
Okay. Yeah, because I looked into emulation at one point. The emulation landscape for Amiga is a little bit cloudy because the ROMs are still owned by this company and you can't boot the emulator without the Kickstart ROM. So you have to so it's not as trivial as emulating other platforms because there's an active company that still owns all that stuff.
Yeah. And they sell a bundle of like, okay, here it is.
Yeah.
Here's the emulator. It's all packaged.
Right.
The flower on top, that's one of the things they do also.
Yeah. I remember seeing that they used to sell a CD that was like double click and here's the whole Amiga experience. Kind of thing. Yeah. Okay, so then the other one I found is sort of another cautionary tale. This one looks suspicious to me. So this is $1,200 US. It's in the US, but this to me appears to be, it's being marketed as original mint condition, but it looks to me aggressively retrobrighted. I don't believe that this is original color. Unless,
terribly
again,
photographed.
Yeah, unless, again, it's hard to tell who knows what the white balance on this camera is doing, but just comparing it to the keys, it looks awfully white to me. So I'm pretty suspicious of this.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. It has. I noticed it has HDMI out on the back.
Yeah, it says decked out. I see a DVI port there. What's that about?
I'm sorry, DVIs.
Okay, that's what you're for. Yeah.
And actually, the fact that this is recapped, like the Amiga 1200 and the Amiga 4000 are notorious for terrible capacitor failure. Like that's an Amiga 1200. At this point, I probably wouldn't buy one unless it had been recapped or unless I was going to have it recapped.
Interesting.
That not so much with the Amiga 500, 1000, 2000, 3000. They don't. I haven't recapped any of mine. But the 1200. Recapped is a big, big plus on eBay.
Okay, that's good to know. Yeah, and this one has got apparently all the mods. I mean, there's a CF card in here, something called Amiga Kit. There's some kind of red board here that's clearly an add-on. One of those is maybe the video converter. There's a 802.11b Wi-Fi thing here. So this close-up of some sort of additional board. I don't know what this is. There's a lot going on here. But yeah, I mean, they're proud of it based on that price. And I am very suspicious of the color of it. That seems like pretty harsh retrobriting to me, but hard to say. I don't know if there is some sort of market for false claims of original retro computers that are being retrobrited. I don't know if people are doing that, but it seems likely that people will start to do that as some of these machines go up in value. Anyway, so that was my little tour through the current state of Amigas on eBay. I thought it was pretty interesting. None of these seem like ones I would run out and buy, but it's sort of cool to see what the market looks like for an aspiring Amiga plaything.
I find the whole topic very interesting. I remember when we were on Chicken Missile, you saying that, how like the idea of you aspire to get an Amiga and it's not a platform you had before. Every time I've mm-hmm. looked at nostalgia purchases or whatever, yeah. it's going back to something. So I'm familiar with it. I know the parts I wanted. But if you go into like a whole ecosystem that you didn't have anything to do with, it can be really daunting. Like how do I get this started? Does it need an operating system? What do I need? What are the things? You have no idea what you don't know about it.
Yeah.
I find that idea very fascinating. Like what would I do if I went and said, I want to get heavily into a Sinclair?
Yeah.
Where do I start? What do I need? What are the things? Yeah. Like, yeah, it's really a very different thing than when you're picking up the thing you had as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. And the appeal of it to me is that, like the Commodore, it's one of those computers that I was very, very jealous of back in the day. Like, I had the one Amiga friend who never shut up about his freaking Amiga. But I was secretly very, very jealous of it. And I really always wanted one. And they just, everything I saw about them was always so amazing. Everything looked and sounded so amazing on them. And so it was this foreign, far off, you know, magical thing. And I think it could be really fun to go back into that world and see what I had missed and see what it was really all about. Was it as good as I always imagined it was or whatever? But yeah, again, it's such a barrier to entry, like not knowing even how to boot it or what software you should buy or how you copy a floppy disk on it. Like what CF card reader or whatever do you need to buy? It's so intimidating. I mean, I imagine someone trying to get into an Apple II now and like, why are there two DOSes and which one should I get? And how do I, you know, boot this thing? Like, you don't know any of this stuff. So I think that's where I talked about on Chicken Missile, you know, there's that book, The New Apple II User's Manual, which is a retro computing guide to the Apple II for modern people. Like, here's how you go into the Apple II not knowing anything about it. If someone writes such a book for the Amiga, shut up and take my money, because I'm all in on that. I want someone to lead me by the hand through this experience. So that's it for my eBay items.
I wonder if there's equivalent books like that for other things. Like, is there one for Amiga, for Commodore 64?
Yeah, I don't know. I hope so. Yeah, the Commodore is another platform that I'm sort of vaguely interested in, but the barrier to entry is high enough that it kind of keeps me out.
Oh, I had so many friends in high school that all had Commodore 64s and constantly showed me their amazing games that I didn't have access to. Oh my gosh, you Commodore people and your amazing games, whatever.
Nice load time, man.
Yeah.
Is that disc spinning? What does that red light mean? It's waiting to spin?
Well, at least the Commodore, like, I know that, okay, I can boot up Vice and there are game packs that you can download. And I feel like I could muddle my way through that and be playing Paradroid in an hour. But, you know, the 16-bit era, that's where suddenly computers became real platforms and the complexity shot through the roof. And so, yeah, I wouldn't even know how to get started.
Yeah. Cool. No, I definitely had that feeling with it. I have booted Pipe Dream on an Amiga, and that's basically as far as I got. So, you know, it worked. That was that proved to me that it worked. But I mean, like, I don't know how to interact with the desktop and make anything do anything.
Oh, hey, in the chat, we have a listener that's in the GTA and here in Toronto. He says, I can borrow a Sinclair gear. That's awesome. Yeah? Hello, Matt. Nice. Hello, fellow Canadian.
Excellent.
I should also, I got to give it a shout out to Jimmy Marr's book, The Future Was Here, book about the Amiga. That was one of the things that really got me hooked. Like, I was always vaguely interested in it, but his book was surprisingly technical. There's a whole section in it, for example, on how the bouncing ball works and the checkered white and red ball that we've all seen. And that demo is vastly, vastly more clever than I realized it was. I just assumed it was, you know, oh, the Amiga can draw these big bitmaps, so they're able to do that stunt. And no, it's actually an extremely clever manipulation of the bit planes and so on. So it's really a good read. I recommend it. He has an ebook version, so I just downloaded that for whatever he's charging for it, and it was a really good read.
Dale Luck.
Yeah. Another thing, by the way, that came through the chat, we were talking a little bit about the video scaler thing that came in the first of the Amiga 500 auctions, and that I thought that looked familiar. It is the Gonbas board, might be the GBS 8200, but at any rate, it's actually relatively obtainable, commonly sourceable board that you can use to make these scalers for a number of different machines. So I know I had thought about trying to set one of these up for the Apple III, and I think it can be done for the Apple TGS too, right? But the Apple III has this sort of XRGB monitor out, which is much like the 2GS, but not quite exactly like the 2GS. So it doesn't work well to plug a 2GS monitor into an Apple III. I'm gesturing to my left because that's where my Apple III is sitting off camera. But it gets the colors wrong. It doesn't quite work. But anyway, so that's what that is called. And I know there has been some work to interface the Apple II with that and other computers as well. So Joe in the chat mentioned that. But
cool. I always wonder with those boards, though, do they introduce latency? Because already if you're talking to an LCD, you've got a bunch of latency. And I feel like the games aren't going to play right if you've also got some kind of video translator board in the loop.
It's always my fear, too.
I have on several of the Amigas that I have owned, and on right now there's one Amiga 2000 that has a similar device that's mounted inside. It's pretty. I mean, I'm running a big 20-inch Sony Trinitron CRT simultaneous to the Amiga's RGB output, so I see them both together, and at least on the two or three different models of ScanDoubler, Flickr Fixer that I've had, it's almost imperceptible. It's in my experience, like I see them right next to each other. And but the thing that I don't like about it is, like, say you're watching like a demo scene production that's smooth scrolling something across the screen, or a game that's running at 60 frames a second uninterlaced, because it's doubling, the scan lines, it's doubling the frequency. Necessarily, like a glass smooth scroll on 15 kilohertz is going to look like it's jumping a pixel, like it very right. slightly jerks, and there's no way around it. And so that's why I'll never, for like demo scene stuff, I'll never switch entirely because seeing something literally glass smooth makes a difference.
That's what I worry about, because a big part of the experience I would want would be the scene demos. And I think about the 2GS, and the 2GS scene demos don't look right on anything besides the original 2GS monitor. Like you talk about things like the split demo where they're rendering text in the border with just unbelievable cycle timing. No emulator does that right. No video processing board does that right. Like it only looks correct on a recently recapped original 2GS monitor. So it's kind of makes sense
if you think about it, because the demo scene people, they're all pushing hardware to its limits and finding weird things. It's like nothing will break an emulator like a demo scene thing.
Yeah, but it's such a great experience to see that. Like, it's so incredible, and it's an experience that's going to get lost because those monitors are not going to last forever, and it kind of makes me sad. But I would want that same experience on the Amiga, because I'm sure equivalent stuff was happening over there.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. That's the main. By far, the main use case I have for the Amiga is demo scene, and it makes a big difference. But I will say my earlier comment, but it is true for like gaming. Aside from fluidity, like joystick lag, that's not a thing with the scan doubler. But yes, as far as glass smooth scrolling, it's very noticeable. And anything you emulate is like that too. An Amiga emulator of any sort is going to effectively be scan doubling, so it can't be smooth.
Yeah.
And various bits of information are going by in the chat, and I'm realizing this is a whole topic.
Excellent. We've entered episode 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
Starting
so again. This is so the Gonbas board, the GBS 8200 was the one that we were talking about before, but I think it can come with an ESP 8266 or not, and you want to have that, and there's a better firmware to use GBS control than the original one, and these are being compared to the OS OpenSC, which is the open source scan converter that you can get in various places. And so maybe this is going to be, you know, whatever, RCR number 229. But so, yeah.
Cool.
So thank you, everybody, for all these bits of information that I'm only barely processing. But apparently, you know, there is some lag introduced. GBS control has, Matt says, GBS control has less tearing than the stock firmware, but the OSSC is noticeably better.
Interesting how we're experiencing these problems all over again. Like video at the time was hard because the 16-bit era of computers is where the horsepower got ahead of the video standards. And so there were no video standards that were good enough for what these computers could do and what they wanted to do. And so they just all made up their own video standards, or they used something that was sort of okay, like the arcade standard, and then modified it. And, you know, it was a problem at the time. You had to have their monitor and it was expensive. And now it's still a problem. And yeah, and like, you couldn't plug those machines into overhead projectors or, you know, any of the other sorts of business situations where you might need to get video out of them. You couldn't. It was this very self-contained thing where you had the computer and the monitor that came with it. And that was the only way to experience it. And yeah, so we're still living with those problems now, trying to emulate those machines and trying to get them running again.
Right, right. I should probably add, since we're now talking and in the chat with about several different models of scan, you know, scan doublers, the one that I'm talking about where I'm not seeing latency, or at least, you know, response latency, is it's a specific one designed for the Amiga that sits, like it replaces the video chip, and you stick the video chip in it, and so it has local memory. It's like two chips, and it's made by a very good company, Indivision. Indivision ECS is the device, Amiga hardware, the guy that makes the Cat Weasel, actually, if you've heard of that drive controller. So I'm not speaking about what these sound like, a little more generalized, like you can use these with a great many more devices, but for this specific use that I'm talking about, I'm not seeing it, but maybe it's got a little bit of an edge.
Cool. Yeah, these scan doubler devices, they're just generic things like that are factories in China crank out, and they have, that's why they have 18 ports all the way around them. They're not specifically designed for any particular application, and so they're not super good at any of what they do. Like I tried to use one for Apple II output one time, and it was terrible. Like the colors were all wrong, and it wouldn't do 80 column text, and yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah, I'll add, like, just this one designed specifically for the Amiga, it actually goes as far as in the FPGA to introduce several additional Amiga OS represented supported graphics modes as if it's sort of like a little video card, as like a little side bonus. So yes, it's not a general purpose video device. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that's good about this, you know, the Gonbus cards kits is the fact that the base unit is super cheap. I mean, you know, like, so, you know, it is a cheap possible way around trying to get a specific video, device for your computer. But anyway, that has been sort of in my plan for something to attempt, because I think it's actually quite easy. You know, like the constructing the thing, you know, out of this is not so hard. So, if I ever get around to that, it's somewhere, you know, not quite at the top of my list of projects, but close-ish. Okay. How's it going? What is Audio Hijack says?
3 hours?
2:55. Yeah. So
we're not being televisionaries. Let's wrap this up.
We made it. We made it. So I think we are at the closing discussions part of the show. Blake, do you have any closing thoughts?
Nothing big. Since we mentioned, was it today? I think it was today that we mentioned the loading of data.
Off
of vinyl. I will say, I mentioned it last time, I'm still quite enjoying the vinyl LP record scenario and having a lot of fun just getting titles I'd never heard of off eBay for really cheap and just having fun with that. And some friends are pitching in with, you know, things that were in their closet. So enjoying that, but you know, not much else to say about that. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and actually, the previous episode, we spent like a very long time talking about records and things record related, just in honor of your not being there.
Now I'm kind of jealous. Well,
next time you can respond.
I laughed when it looked like you weren't going to make it to the show, Blake, because I knew I was going to spend all this time talking about Amiga stuff, and you weren't here for the Amiga talk or the record player talk.
I'm glad I made it. I'm glad I made it. So.
Yeah. Excellent. Carrington, do you have any closing thoughts? Have you set up your G4 iMac? Asks the chat.
Okay, here's the thing. It's still in the box, but it's moved from behind me to beside me. But it's still in the box. And it's like I'm thinking, I wanted this thing for so long. Now I have one, beautiful, in the box. Presumably it survived shipping. I haven't even opened it up to look. It's still sitting there. I have a box that feels about as heavy as it should. Mm-hmm. This is what I know. Oh, 2 weeks later, still haven't even opened it up. I'm already regretting having another thing. It's like a thing I now have to have and clean and so.
Is it sort of like a, what are those, weeping angels or whatever, where if you don't look at it, it like moves closer?
But don't look at it, the box moves. So I will set it up. I'm interested in playing some games. I would definitely take it out of the box at some point and stick it on the desk here beside me. And I will play some games and we will see how quickly I put it back on eBay or something like that. But right now, I'm enjoying having the box. I like to want things sometimes more than I want to actually have it. Like the chase, the anticipation, the thinking about a thing. Sometimes I enjoy that more than the actual possession. So we'll see once I open it up if I actually still like it. I think I'm going to be happy with it. I think I will too. So we will see. But no, I have not opened it up.
Yeah, they just have this. You know, we were talking about this before, but like this built-in sort of expression. Yeah. You know that.
And I've never had one before.
You can't be mad at it.
I love the era, but I've never owned one of these iMac G4s before. And this is the particular model I've always wanted, so I think I'm going to love it. And in fact, speaking of records, that's why behind me, normally there's emptiness. My record player moved over to there because I slid the box where the record player goes, so I slid it out of the way. So now there's a thing behind me. Look, I have things.
You have thing.
I have thing.
It's so messy, Carrington. Jeez.
I know. I have plants. Look, I have like three plants now. I'm like a dad.
It almost looks like someone lives in your apartment.
Almost looks like I wasn't recently robbed. Just need to set up that futon and get that perfect high school student look. So now my record. You can see my whole audio system behind me. Look at that. Look at that tower of almost nothing.
Excellent.
So yeah, I have not opened it up yet. Is the short answer to that? No.
Okay. I guess I'm next in the alphabetical list. I will briefly say that I have collected a couple of things. Oh, and I did. I got the Apple mouse that isn't a mouse. The whatever it is, Keytronic 91 key.
Oh, so it came
thing.
In. You got two of those, right?
I did. I got two of them. They were both the same. I don't. I didn't bring them all the way here. I took photographs of them, but I left them where all the rest of my, you know, Apple IIs are. So I don't have any. I don't have anything I could install it in. But so I now understand how it works, and I was sort of right, you know, like about how it was going to plug in between the keyboard and the, like you plug it into where the keyboard goes, and then you plug the keyboard into it, and then you sort of snake a little. I don't know what you call those things, but what do you call those things? It's a switch that interrupts or connects, you know, like two wires. It's pretty straightforward, simple switch. And that's like the special command key. So you hold that down and then you hit, you know, like whatever it is, your macro key is like the special key C or the special key D. So C will give you catalog and ProDOS will give you more characters than fit on your screen.
And at the end of the year, they will email you how much time you saved.
Yeah. Yes. Momentary switch. That's the name of it. Herb in the chat told me momentary switch. Yes. Yeah. On Facebook, we've been communicating about this, and I got it. I took photographs of it. I posted them into Facebook, and then I didn't actually bring it back, so I can't scan it. But anyway, so there's a couple of these out there now. Herb said he got it actually specifically because he heard us talking about it. So very nice. Anyway, what else? Oh yeah, and I also brought back my iBook SE with the I can grab it.
I like those.
Yeah, it is my iBook SE that does not have the little leaf in the Apple.
Oh yeah, they lose that leaf.
Yeah, so I played Snood.
I like Snood.
And then I put it back away.
Oh my gosh, I haven't thought of Snood in forever. I like Snood. Yeah. So how's that giant bezel treating you?
It's pretty nice.
Those things, I was like, oh, there's a lot of white space around this monitor.
Yeah. It's cool, though. It's cool that they work.
Put post-it notes in there.
Yeah. That's true. Exactly right. It's that you need a place to stick the post-it notes.
Exactly. Yeah.
But anyway, that's about it. So, yeah. I brought back that and my Duo 2300C. And I've started them both. They actually both can use the same power adapter, which is nice.
Oh. Cool.
And that's about it. That's my own news. Quinn, what are your closing thoughts?
I don't have much retro computing going on, other than I get to look at my Apple II disk images a lot now. I got a new audio recorder for my YouTube channel for recording a second audio track, and it uses the micro SD cards. And the only one I had was the one from my floppy Emu that's in the box with my Apple IIc Plus. So I pulled that out and I use it in that recorder. So now every time I transfer the audio off the recorder, I see my little folder with all my Apple II disk images sitting there. So that's the extent of my retro computing right now.
The entire set of Apple II disk images being much less than any of the audio recording files.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The entire Apple II library is half of 1 minute of my audio. Yeah.
In similar fashion, I get to feel the nostalgia for the TI-99 4A and the Amiga 2000. Whenever I interact with either of them, they share an SD card for their floppy emulator. So I put one in. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember Munchman. And then, oh, yes, I need to play some, you know, Shadow of the Beast. So
that's the other thing is I'm feeling guilty a lot lately about because we've been talking about the 9918 video chip and the F18A and all that. And I'm feeling guilty about that a lot because I still have a roughly 2/3 implemented video board for Veronica, my homebrew ABIC computer based on that chip. And I bought an F18A to put in it and I have it about half working. I have text rendering on the screen. And then it's been sitting on my workbench for 2 years waiting for me to finish it. So
at least you've got the device.
Yeah. I'm glad I bought it when I did. Cause yeah, holy cow, they are unobtainium now. And I've been talking to that guy a bit and he says he is still working on the second one, the sequel to it, but it's a difficult device and he's not getting paid for it. So it's not going to happen anytime soon. It's the way of these devices.
You gotta get them while you can.
I hope that they do, you know, come out again and become relatively easy to get, because that would be that's like the vid HD. That's another thing that would be really pretty cool for people to widely have in their Apple IIs.
Yeah, the F18A is an outstanding device. Like, it's the simplest thing you could ever ask for. It's this: you put it on a breadboard, you put 5 volts on it, and you get beautiful video hardware, video output out of anything you want to build. So it's really a dream device. But the unobtainiumness of it is a problem. Like, I have had 2 close calls with it. I almost burnt it out twice and that would have been super sad because you can't get them. So there's one, it has a known issue where, if you do one little thing slightly wrong with it, it tends to burn out one of the buffers on it. And I've burnt out that buffer twice now. And I actually talked to the guy and he's like, yeah, sorry, I should have fixed that and never did. So I actually had to learn surface mount soldering because I've had to replace the buffer on this thing twice. And wow. So I've gotten pretty good at that. But yeah, it's scary because every time you do that, there's a big risk of damaging something worse in the process of fixing it. And one of these days I may fail at fixing it and I may, you know, lift a trace off the board or, you know, separate, you know, one of the layers or something and then it's toast. So I kind of handle it with kid gloves. I'm scared of burning it out because it's not replaceable.
So I assume an actual 9918 doesn't do all that same stuff, right? I mean, like you can't just take a whatever it is, like a TI-99-4A.
Right. So what you get with his device is you get modern video output out of it. So you get VGA, the new one's going to have HDMI, so that the 9918A has composite right on the chip. So you can get composite video out of it, but it also doesn't have all of the supporting hardware. So you need buffers to talk to it. You need it has its own video RAM. So you have to set up 64K of video RAM and do all the interfacing and glue logic between the 9918A and the RAM. So the F18A is all of that stuff for you. So you don't have to set up the video, the VRAM bus and do all this. It has set up its own, it needs its own clocks and it needs its own video sync and all this other stuff. So he's basically solved all of the infrastructure for you. And that's what's really nice about it, because any standalone video chip is a lot of work to use. You have to build a whole infrastructure around it that's difficult to get working. And then at best, you get composite video out of it, because that's what was the standard at the time of these things. So, because, yeah, I've looked at, like, a lot of people build homebrew computers around, like, the Yamaha, was it 9988 or something? There's the successor to the 9918. There was this Yamaha chip that was really, really cool. But again, you got to build all this infrastructure around it. It has RGB video output out of it, like arcade video output. So now you got to build some kind of video circuit that can either do VGA or try to get something else out of it that you can display. And you know, again, it needs video RAM and it needs a clock and it needs buffers and all this other stuff. You need to have to do address decoding logic. And anyway, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Not to mention it has a dramatically higher palette. You know, I think it's got, like, 16-bit palette or 24-bit palette, something like that, if you wanted to tap into that extra features, which you would if you're going to, build a unique system out of it.
And even just the fact that, like, in a couple of hours, you can have text displaying in color, and moving blocks of color out of a homebrew computer, like, that's very difficult to do. Like, I'm surprised that, like, there is a market for that. If somebody made that device for all the people that want to, generate video from an Arduino or, play with that kind of stuff. Because just like it was in the 80s, generating video is the hardest part of homebrew computing and simple computer systems. Mm-hmm. So a plug and play video solution, I think there's a big market for that.
All right. I think we made it. I think it's about time to close this down and everybody escape. But I never know when we start, how long we're going to go. But because last time it was pretty funny, actually, how we really had just like a couple of like nothings and it still ran 2 hours. But this is very interesting, though. All right, I will say that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.net. And please write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro Compute! Oh my gosh.
Look at the graphics.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Where were these graphics through the whole show?
Yeah. People not watching the stream are missing out. That was worth 3 hours waiting for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.